The meeting will come to order and the, yes, well, through the phone, there's more than quite a bit. The first bill on the calendar is House File 1726, Representative Thiessen. And does somebody want to move his bill?
I'll move, Mr. Chair.
That's a good start. Representative Thiessen, House File 1726, Representative Thiessen, we see some, before you start, just I'm trying to figure out, are any of these amendments yours or?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
Oh, no.
I don't think they are.
I think you'd be aware of them.
Yes.
Your own errands. Although from the history of the bill, I've heard. Representative Thiessen, go ahead. And what we're going to do is we have such a heavy load of files in here. I think we'll give you and the opponents roughly about 7 to 8 minutes and then, each. And then we'll give about 15 minutes for the discussion and amendments and everything like that. So go ahead and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 1726 is the Minnesota Health Records Act. It's an initiative of Governor Pawlenty and the Department of Health. And largely what it does, it's a very thick bill, but most of the language in there is actually current law. And I think that's the first point we need to make. It's just being reorganized in a more understandable and rational way. But there are some changes, and that's what I'd like to highlight briefly, and then I'm going to have Mr. Golden from the department explain in a little more detail. A couple of things. First of all, there's some definitions added that actually tighten up Minnesota law and afford more privacy protection. A definition of health records, which we've never had in Minnesota law before. And so it kind of takes away the interpretation. And these definition changes are all erring on the conservative side, so the tighter side compared to the legal interpretations out there today. The second thing is it addresses for the first time in law an entity called a record locator service. And what that is, and I think there's some misperception about what that is. Remember, there's no medical records in a record locator service. All it is the name of a provider and a person and attached to your name. So basically, it's the names of the providers that you've gone to, but there's actually no medical records attached to that name. The second thing is that it's important to know is under the bill, only a provider can access the record locator service. And that's been, I think, there's misunderstanding about that. Insurance companies can't, the state of Minnesota can't, employers cannot. It's only your provider, and the provider can only get it with your consent, with your, we may add written, I guess, but with your consent to do that. And there's an opt-out provision and that we've worked quite hard on to work with people to allow people to say, you know, I don't want my name and the name of my providers there, so we'll take that out. The other thing that's important to know is that these entities exist today just unregulated. So there's record locator services out there, and there's a variety of interpretations of what kind of consent is required both to put information in, which is largely none, and to pass it out. And so today there are some places where record locator services actually pass out names without consent. And if we don't pass this bill, that will continue. I think that's correct understanding, and Mr. Golden can address that. The last thing it does is it creates a new item for communications between providers, which is called a representation. So under current law, you would have to sign a written consent and get it to another provider. One provider would have to get a written consent to you and send it to another provider, and then that consent would have to be before the other provider can send the information back. There's a new concept created here called a representation where the initial provider actually gets a written consent from you but can represent to another doctor that he has the written consent. This makes the exchange of electronic records work much more efficiently, much more effectively. And that last point is really what's important because what this bill is really about is trying to make the exchange of electronic records work in the 21st century, while protecting privacy and creating, in fact, more privacy protection in many ways. So I'm going to turn over to Mr. Golden briefly to walk through the act.
Representative Thiessen, just before you go there, I just wanted to let, how many want to testify in opposition to this bill? Two people? Okay, before that time, could the two of you get together and determine the split on the time? Just okay,
thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Go ahead. Mr.
Golden,
is that okay with the chair?
Yes. Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Golden. I am with the Minnesota Department of Health. Mr. Chair, committee members, this initiative comes out of the state's e-health initiative, which is looking at how to use electronic health records and health information technology to improve the care that's provided through physicians' offices. One of the things that we know is that clinicians often provide care to individuals without knowing what's been done previously, by whom, and this often leads to treatments that are redundant, ineffective, and even dangerous. And one of the major causes of that is because quite often information is not able to flow efficiently from one provider to another. And that's what the industry is looking to try to use health information technology to resolve. In trying to look at how to resolve those issues, one of the biggest barriers that they found is that our patient consent laws, which were written at a time before we envisioned having electronic health records, just need to be updated to be consistent with the electronic environment that we have today. And the biggest problem that they have noted is that, generally speaking, because the statutes aren't clear about some of the concepts that exist in the electronic world, providers have been forced to try to interpret statutes that were written quite long ago with how to apply those to new electronic concepts. So generally speaking, providers don't agree on when or how patient consent is needed. As Representative Thiessen said, this bill does primarily three things. One, it adds some definitions to the current statute to try to eliminate some of the ambiguities associated with patient consent. All of the definitions that we have added have tried to increase the patient's ability to control when their records are released or exchanged between providers. The other concept that has been added to this is a record locator service. Essentially, a record locator service is an index that allows a provider to find your records. So, for example, when a provider needs to know where you might have your records, they're able to use an index which would contain your identifying information, so it uniquely identifies me within there, and then simply has a pointer to the health facility or provider that has my record. Beyond that, there is no other health information in there. Some of the protections that Representative Thiessen certainly named are all there. The other major concept that is introduced in this bill is the idea of representation. And the way that works, and the reason that that's important, I think, is to understand what one of the major barriers to information moving electronically today is. When I go to a provider, and that provider needs some information, for that information to get to that treating provider, they're going to ask me to sign a consent. Once I sign that consent, it's going to have to be faxed over in paper to the disclosing provider, and because all of the liability associated with inappropriate disclosures resides with that disclosing provider, they're going to take a look at this consent and make sure it meets their criteria before they send any information. The difficulty is that this is going to really prohibit the information moving in a real time at the point of care when it's needed. What this does is it still allows the patient to consent. So once that physician or provider gets the patient's consent, they're able to communicate that to the disclosing provider so that they are able to disclose those records in real time electronically to the point of care where I have just consented to the provider who is treating me and has requested those records. The other thing that is done in the bill, because current law essentially places all of the liability on the disclosing provider, in this case because it's the requesting provider and disclosing provider share responsibility for obtaining the consent, it also introduces a mechanism that basically allocates the liability to a bad actor someone who has misrepresented or lied about the patient having obtained or provided consent associated with any exchange of information between providers.
And just one more thing, Mr. Chair, if I may, because I want to get kind of at one of the issues that's been talked about quickly, and that is with the RLS, one of the biggest contentions here is with the RLS, putting your name into the RLS with the name of your providers is done without consent in this bill. And the reason for that is so we have an effective system up front. If we don't, if we require consent going in as opposed to the opt-out, which we have in here, all your records going back in time, all the names of your providers back in time, which is really the information you're trying to get, won't get into the system. And so I just wanted to highlight that issue for folks, because that's really one of the kind of issues I think we'll hear about. And we can talk more about that subsequently. Okay. But that, I think, is it.
You just made your time.
Just made it. Good.
Mr. Neumeister and Ms. Brace, however you want to split your...
Mr. Chairman, could you please share with us, too, the amount of time that the other side got?
They got 8 minutes.
So, okay, that's what I was thinking. So, make sure.
They got actually 7.5.
If you want to get that. You're embarrassed tonight, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. 29 years ago, I came before this body, this committee, the House of Representatives, and the Senate, and helped start where Minnesota, along with policymakers who are still here and some who are not, where in the state of Minnesota we were the first to be able to get access to our full medical records. We were the first to be able to get free copies of some of our medical care, the first to be able to opt out of research, and the first in many kinds of things where I've worked with a lot of your predecessors and current people now. And one of the things that we're doing, we're going to be first to do some electronic things that no other state has done yet and put it into language, but at a price of what? I believe at the price of the privacy and the strides that we have made over these 29 years. Now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I contend that we can still be in the electronic age and still hold choice, autonomy, and make decisions where our medical records can go. Now, in regards to the RLS, RLS is name and provider. It is a footprint. A provider can be a mental health person. Look in 144 at the definition of provider, and you have from ophthalmologists to all kinds of different people. An association of a name and a provider can tell you something. The point that I disagree with so strongly and principally is that someone is taking that information without opt-in. The national government, which has committees and things doing with that, Mr. Chairman, could you please tell me when I may have about 2 minutes left and then 30 seconds left?
Okay. You're getting close to the 2 minutes.
The government does say, and national studies say, let's have a real full discussion about opt-in and opt-out, because these are records about ourselves. I contend in a 9 to 15 member committee, which I was the only patient representative on, there was not really a full discussion. There was a wide range of options and all that played out, but if we want to talk about wide range and full discussion, I contend that was not there. But we're here now. I suggest opt-in. Secondly, about the representation of language, that is a first. And that's what I really oppose, is the representation of A to B, doing it by email or whatever. Now, I'd like to hand something out to you. If you could please give this to the members. What you have here are basic surveys. One talks about how your constituents, maybe you yourselves, have some deep concerns about electronic records and also a recent poll. On the issue of representation, I contend, take that out. Let's have more thorough discussion about that. I think you are opening up on unsecure systems, which I have no idea about. Secondly, I have no idea about the authentication of how, who is going to see and what they're going to see. Identity, medical identity fraud. The DAO also has a report, which I've referred to, lists a number of issues.
don't have time to discuss some aspects of that. So Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in summary, opt out, I prefer not. Opt in, but opt out can always be worked on. But representation, let's pull that out and work on that a little bit more for next year.
Thank you,
thank
Mr.
you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Ms. Grace.
Mr. Chair, Twyla Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare. First question is, how many minutes do I have?
Four.
Okay. I have 4 minutes to talk to you about what I consider to be a very critical issue having to do with patient privacy and medical privacy and what's going to happen to your private data. We've long been involved in protecting the privacy of data as well as protecting patients' consent for deciding what actually happens to their data. House File 1726 is essentially an online medical records bill, and it will create the precedent for what will happen into the future with electronic medical records. And as such, it's a major shift in policy. So I'm going to just tell you from a letter from the Department of Health what they said. And they said that this proposal is the department's proposal for eliminating patient consent-related barriers to the electronic exchange of health information. We have several serious concerns about this bill, and I'll share a few, and then I'll request 3 changes. So the first one, just to let you know that Minnesota does have the strongest medical privacy law in the nation, but this bill would change that by reducing longstanding privacy rights as longstanding consent rights, determining where your information can go. The second thing I'm going to talk about is the proposed record locator service. And I hope that Mr. Chair, I hope that you are not offended. I just sort of wanted to move you because you're the chair. And so I'll give you at least this one so you can see. I wanted to give everyone an idea of what it means to be in a record locator service. And so I used fake data for Representative Mullery. Fake data except what we have in the Green Book. But it gives you sort of an idea of what could be there as far as identifying information for you. It's all fake data. All fake. I know nothing about Representative.
Ms. Grace, you think I'm happy to have you? I mean, I don't know that there's a lot of things, but
it's all,
yeah, she's passing off personal information about me. Very tactical, Ms. Grace.
Well, actually, Representative Mullery, all of that's in the Green Book.
Do you want to do that for yourself?
and all the other information is just made up. So it's just made up. But it's to give you, I mean, I don't know your social security number, right? So the whole idea is what the kind of identifying information could be that would be on a record locator service, as well as every clinic that Representative Mullery or any of you would have been to. So this is all made up, and I apologize, Representative Mullery, if I have offended you. I really do apologize. I'm trying to make a point as to what data can be put on the record locator service without your consent. So I just put in numbers as the keyboard was there. So anyway, the point I'm making is that you don't have any consent for what goes on to the record locator service. And our organization really wants you to have consent before any kind of information is put on there. Because it's all online. Because everything there is online and hackable. So if it's your social security number that gets put on, it'll be your social security number that'll be hackable. You also notice that whatever kind of clinics you've been to say a lot about perhaps what happened to you. If you've been to an orthopedic clinic, if you've been to a dermatologic clinic, if you've been to an oncology clinic, all of that stuff will be in the record locator service. And all of that stuff gets put on without your consent. And so when you give consent at some point for your doctor to see or to go into the record locator service, this is what can come up for your doctor to see, and you may not know that all of that has been placed in there. So what we really want is we want patient consent before that information, that kind of information, goes into the record locator service. Because this is the first time that your information gets shared and gets sent out of your clinic without consent. and it's being put online. So that's really the point that I want to make. And the other point that I want to make is that in 2002, the state came and tried to get all of your medical record information. And here's that, here's something from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, which is that the state withdraws plan to collect health data.
Ms. Brace, you have about 20 seconds.
All right. And so we see the move to online medical records without consent. We see all of this drive going to the health department having access to all of our medical records in a way that they would not have had and could not have had without an electronic medical data system. So I ask you to keep in mind that we would like patient consent, and we would also like the representation of patient consent to be removed from the bill as well. Thank you very much.
I see, after looking at it, I see a lot of it's made up, but the worst offense is saying that I went to Washburn High School. I'm not a cake eater.
No. And Mr. Chair, that is true. I completely made that up. I was just trying to think of a Minneapolis school since you're from Minneapolis, so
okay.
Thank you very much.
No, we have, and we already have representation if you want to step forward. There's four amendments, so members are going to have to be succinct so that we can get these done in the 15 minutes. Who has the first, I think Representative Falls?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer just walked in. He was going to offer this amendment. He may have one other, but I've chatted with Representative Thiessen, and he's talked with the department. The A13 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The A13 amendment simply provides that the Minnesota Department of Health may not access the record locator service or receive data from the record locator service. According to Representative Thiessen, I think he's fine with it, so I'd move the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, that's the intent of the bill, and I think that's how the language reads now, that only a provider can, but I'm happy to put that language on.
Representative Coles moves Amendment A13, and
is that okay, Tim?
Apparently it's agreed with everyone. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Next amendment.
Which one do you want to do, Mr. Chairman?
How about the A9?
Do you have the three, or does...
Actually, the A9 we can withdraw. I believe you've already covered that, Representative Thiessen.
Okay.
Is that correct?
Which is it?
The A9 is the no person other than a provider?
Yes. That's the bill.
Yep, you've already addressed that.
Okay, so the A9 is withdrawn.
Then we would go to the A7. Okay. Although I'm going to need some help because of the delete all. As to the page and line.
No.
It's this one. Yeah. You know which one I'm talking about.
Or
Right. So, Mr. Chair, this the A7 amendment. We didn't have the engrossment when this was printed out. So, the appropriate page and line reference would be page 6, line 6.
Okay. Representative Immer offers the A7 amendment, and I guess we have to technically treat the insertion of page 6, line 6 as an amendment. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Okay, we have the A7 amendment as amended in front of us. Representative Immer?
Mr. Chair, I've had this discussion with Representative Thiessen in the past. I don't know how he feels about it right now. But this is just requiring, it's inserting language that would require a signed and dated written consent from the patient, which specifically authorizes disclosure to a record locator. And I'm assuming since I walked in late that the author and the committee have discussed the significance is the opt-in, opt-out. That's the debate. And all this amendment does is require that there be a signed written consent before it can be disclosed to an RLS.
I oppose this. I mean, this is the policy debate. As I said earlier, what this debate really is about is how provider names get into the record locator service. And it really is a policy decision for the committee. The reason we're proceeding with the without consent language is because that allows us to build the record locator service with past medical records. So, for instance, if you're seeing Dr. A today, and 5 years ago you saw Dr. B and C, you know, in the past 10 years, they're not going to be able to put their records in. So it kind of doesn't, it's not very useful to, it won't be useful for quite a long time if you require consent to put the name, and all we're doing again is putting the name of the provider into this service, because you're not going to pick up all your past medical providers. I mean, the pointer won't have any information. So that's why I would oppose it, and again, just to reiterate, to access this record locator service, only a provider can access it, only with your consent. You know, so provider has to get your consent before they go online. And we just put in the language so the Department of Health can't get in there. And there's opt-out provisions. So when you go to your provider and they say, can I access the record locator service, for instance, there's going to be a form that says, you can't access this. In fact, I want you to send this into the record locator service and take my name out of there. So we tried to put in a lot of protections to get at this issue. And I guess the other thing, just kind of in fairness, I'm not sure the amendment does exactly what Representative Emmer wants to do, because the word "not" is not in the sentence.
Right.
We have this. Okay.
That I'll address that when you're done.
Okay. So that's my. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. That is correct. Just so the committee knows, what Representative Thiessen just referred to is that, as it was originally offered in another committee, it was a true opt-in, opt-out. It had the word "not," which would require a affirmative opt-in. What I've done here is, in an effort to try and reach some type of agreement, have taken out the word "not," and we're requiring this written consent, because, as you'll see from the next amendment, I'll preface it so we don't spend as much time. This consent issue is also a big part of it, is the representation of consent and how consent is going to be given. So I'd ask for your support, Mr. Chairman. I would ask for a roll call.
We're back.
Representative Paul.
I didn't ask for it, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, did I miss new rules? Or?
And Mr. Chair, I think that is a very legitimate policy discussion to have. So,
any further discussion, or can we go ahead and vote? Okay, clerk will call the roll.
Paul.
No, no. On the A7 amendment.
Oh, the vote, if you agree with Representative Emmer's amendment, then you vote aye. If you agree with the author, then you vote no.
On the A7 amendment.
No.
Chairman.
Trying to get this going.
Okay, so that's a no. Representative Bingham. Representative Cornish.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So the eighth, yeah, pass on this amendment.
Okay, we'll come back. Representative Cornish.
Aye.
Representative De La Forest. Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Hoberg. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kalin.
No.
Representative Cole.
Yes.
Representative Kranz.
No.
Representative Lesh. Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Olin.
No.
Representative Hamer.
No.
Representative Saylor.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Westrom. Representative Bigham.
No.
Fails 5-9. Representative Emmer is one of these other.
One more, Mr. Chair. I move the A-10.
Okay. Is that?
It was just passed out. Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you, Representative Emmer. The Representative Emmer moves the A-10 amendment, and would you like to explain?
Very quickly, I will. Since the majority of the references are on page 10, if you turn to page 10 and you review starting at line 11, you'll see this representation of consent. And again, it is a. I appreciate the chair's patience with me in allowing me to offer these, because these are they go right to the heart of the policy debate. From my point of view, and I've had this discussion with the author and with the folks that are helping him with the bill, I don't accept the premise that this will never be available. And if you read the bill closely, when we're looking at related healthcare entities, when we're looking at the definition of affiliate, there were discussions that I will not have again here tonight in other committees about what we're creating here. And there is a genuine disagreement on a policy level as to whether folks should be required to opt out or to allow these folks to represent that they have our consent to obtain records and pass things back and forth on the RLS. This is taking out the language or representation of consent. So it restricts that. It's that basic, Mr. Chairman. And again, if you'd accept to be more patient, I'd ask for a roll call on this one, too. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Emmer and Representative Keith.
Thank you, Representative, or Mr. Chair. First of all, just on the issues of related healthcare entities and affiliates, one of the things that's important to note is those are actually narrower definitions. We're narrowing Minnesota law as to what those things are in this bill. Just to explain again what the representation is, because this, again, is a legitimate policy discussion to have. Representative Emmer and I have talked about it quite a bit. Where the representation comes into play is when one doctor is communicating with another doctor. So you go to see Dr. A, and you know, he says, well, I need to get these records from Dr. B. And under current law, what you'd have to do is sign a consent form, a written consent form, fax that over, and then Dr. B would get that and take it and say, okay, this does it, and then ship your records over. What we're doing with the representation is to say Dr. A gets this representation and it's gets the consent from the patient and calls up or communicates with Dr. B and says, I represent that I have this consent in my possession. With that, Dr. B can take that representation as fact. You know, and no doctor has to do that. You can require consent as well. I mean, there's nothing saying Dr. B couldn't say, no, you better send me a written consent. But Dr. B could say, if he knows the other doctor, for instance, is familiar, knows he's the real thing, could say, okay, I'll take your representation as true. And then in the liability side, what we're doing is saying the liability isn't with Dr. B anymore. If Dr. A is lying, it's on Dr. A. And that's what the liability piece is. So we're setting up a legal liability system that kind of gets at the same issue of actually faxing over the written consent. And kind of the practical reason for this, as Mr. Golden has said, is that we want, this just allows the information to move much more easily kind of in real time. So that's where we are.
Mr. Chair, I know you don't want much discussion, but I just need to add to this. Just keep in mind, folks, that every time you go into a new provider's office, how many forms you're filling out, how many forms you're asked to sign for you, how many forms you're asked to sign for your kids. Ask yourselves or think to yourselves, how much is on all these forms? And the print's all different, everything else. The question has never been answered to me, and this is the reason that we're pressing on this issue, legitimate policy debate, is what happens when that consent is somehow in the language of the forms you're signing, and that is used as the representation.
And Mr. Chair, just to that point, I think, you know, that's an issue, but that's an issue whether we do a representation or not. Because you still have to get the written consent. The provider A can't do this without the written consent.
Okay, is there any other discussion, or can we vote on it?
Mr. Chair, just very briefly.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Emmer for bringing this amendment forward. I've had a brief conversation with the author. When Mr. Golden first came and visited me in my office, I didn't even talk with anybody about this bill yet. And as I looked through the bill, as I paged through it, this representation issue jumped out at me before it was brought to my attention. It's something that I still have some concerns about. I support
the policy here, what we're trying to do at the 30,000-foot level, but often, as we know, the devil's in the details, and this is something that I'm just not entirely comfortable with yet. I had some conversations today with some folks about, you know, how we could maybe make this work better. I hope that as this moves forward, Representative Thiessen, that if it gets out of here today, if Representative Emmer's amendment does not go on, that you continue to look at this issue, whether we look at something like we do in financial transactions with e-sign, whether we are, you know, whether we look at transmitting the consent electronically, scanning it and transmitting it. I think there are ways, as we talk about moving into the 21st century, I think we can figure out a way to accommodate making sure that provider B actually has that consent in his or her hands. So I intend to vote yes on the amendment. I appreciate where this is headed. I support, as I said, the policy from 30,000 feet. I'm just a little concerned yet about some of the details as we drill down. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Emmer, for bringing this forward.
And we're already at the complete time for discussion, amendments, and everything. So we will then all in favor. Was there a roll? Okay, then the chair will call the roll.
On the A-10 amendment, Chairman Mullery.
No.
Representative Bingham.
No.
Representative Cornish.
Aye.
Representative De La Forest. Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Holberg. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kalin.
No.
Representative Coles.
Yes.
Representative Kranz.
No.
Representative Lesch. Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Owens.
No.
Representative Paymer.
No.
Representative Taylor.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Westrom.
Yes.
Okay, the amendment fails 6-9. There's about 1 minute left for discussion if people really want to do it. Can we just...
And Mr. Chair, I would just say, I think the amendments actually were the fundamental discussion on the bill. Those are the two pieces.
Is it okay?
Mr. Chair? I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Thiessen, and actually two of the issues that Representative Emmer raised, and I thank Representative Coles. I had to think a little bit about whether I wanted to vote for that specific language on board, but I think that I'm quite concerned in what Representative about the consent issue here, and what Representative Emmer raised is actually a point for the specific language that he's brought forward made me actually want to vote no, but I'm very interested and engaged in how we resolve this. I'm just afraid that there's so much consenting that goes on and so much information that happens and what can be moments of anxiety or crisis that I think this specific consent would get lost in that moment, but I think that there's a way, I think we need to continue to work those problems through. But I'm actually, as someone who is closely connected through relationship to health providers, that the access to records that's being resolved here that Representative Thiessen and the department are working on, I really highly applaud you and look forward to finding sort of the third way, maybe, that Representative Coles is mentioning.
Okay. Then Representative...
Kalin. I believe I did.
Oh, Representative...
I'll renew my motion.
Kalin renews his motion. And I believe... Pass and it's supposed to finance.
As the chair...
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Is Representative Marquardt in the room? No, okay, Representative Paymer, are you ready? Representative Paymer, where does this go?
To here.
To here?
Yeah. I move file 907 to be included in the omnibus bill.
Representative Paymer, I think they're put together already, so I think we'd have to send it on its own to the floor, I believe.
Okay, your bill?
Pardon?
Your bill is all put together?
I think it is.
That's not.
Is it?
Oh, okay.
Representative Paymar, you're right. It can go there.
Yes.
It's laid over for possible inclusion in the crime omnibus.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Paymar.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members, this is should be very quick. This is brought to us by the Department of Corrections. House File 907 revises a statute that is needed to eliminate confusion that may be caused by current statutory language regarding the assessment and transfer of mentally ill offenders to the Department of Corrections Mental Health Unit at the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Oak Park Heights. And with me today is Steve Allen from the Department of Corrections that will explain more about the bill.
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair and members, this is a fairly brief and narrow request that we're making, so I'll try to be as concise as possible, and if you have questions, please ask. We are looking to change a few words in the statute that specifically relates to the mental health unit at our Oak Park Heights facility. Within that statute, the ability to transfer offenders to that facility includes language such as examining. That has created confusion with a different statute, 253B, which is the Mental Health Commitment Act. In that act, there's another use of the word examiner, which is narrowly defined as along several healthcare providers, including medical doctors and PhD-level psychologists. This has created some confusion in those transfers, and we request that that language be removed.
Pretty simple. Does anyone want to discuss this? Can we move on? Okay. All in, Representative Paymar, or no, the chair will lay this over for possible inclusion. Is Mark Ward here yet?
Yeah.
Can you go find your client? Representative Lilly, you can apparently do 1919. We'll get that going. Representative Lilly, this is apparently, isn't it? Can you find this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's House File 1919. It's a bill for Representative Mark Clark. Mm-hmm. We have some testifiers here that could perhaps tell you about the bill, sir, if you'd like to move it.
It's a very technical real estate law bill, so I expect that you are going to explain it, Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly, do you want to move your bill?
Yes,
This is for possible inclusion. This one goes? Okay. Representative Lilly, the move would be to send it to the general register.
So move, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor. I come from city council.
You have some witnesses to help you explain it when you forget a part of it or something.
Mr. Chair and members, we have some testifiers here. Maybe they could introduce themselves and tell a little bit about the bill.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mike Welling. I am the president of the Minnesota Association of County Surveyors. And I've been working with a subcommittee made up of the Minnesota Association of County Surveyors and the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors, who represent the majority of the private practice land surveyors. The Association of County Surveyors obviously represents the county surveyors from the public standpoint. Basically what we've done is we've worked together to revise the statute that governs platting, which is creating subdivision plats. The existing statute is quite outdated. There's a number of issues in there as far as the actual material that the plats are prepared on, and there was a lot of redundancy in there. We've worked with the State Bar Association, the recorders, the association of Minnesota counties, cities, townships, recorders, pretty much all entities have worked together on this, and there's disagreement. We're still in the process of working on some details with the State Bar Association, but for the most part, everyone's in agreement on the revisions. I guess I could get into detail, or I think we can see if you have any questions.
Do you have another witness representing Lowell?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair.
My name is Lynn Caswell, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm a past president of Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors and also a member of the committee that worked on this revision.
Okay. Mr. Welling, you say that the Bar Association has some concerns. What are those concerns?
Well, there's just a few minor details on some of the language that they're still working on, some of the terms, and I think that they have agreed that they could work it out at the Senate level.
Okay, so because of the 2-week extra deadlines, is that it? Is it?
I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct.
Okay. Because if the Bar Association has problems with it,
no,
I'll be moving for...
Mr. Chair and members, I just had some wisdom put in my ear, and I understand they were negotiating up till 3 o'clock, and the Bar Association is in good shape with this bill. And,
Mr. Bird?
Lloyd Bruce told me that it's not the Bar Association, it's the real property section of the bar.
Right.
He
well,
really supports it. He wanted to make sure we didn't run with the bar.
The real,
only the real property section.
They do support it.
That's correct.
Well, that's the only one that I'm not concerned with. The personal injury lawyers know how to go through this plat survey. Okay, it sounds like, is there any opposition? Okay, is there any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Representative Lilly, a great job of technical explanation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I tried to fill out one of those forms about your medical history.
Is that one that's just for informational?
Right on.
And what are Walker's Square and what? Representative Abney, you're up. And this is, remember, this is an informational, I believe, hearing that this is one of the many bills that didn't move here from overnight. There was some things not done, so we don't have the bill. So all we can do is have the informational hearing. We'll have to vote on it when we get the bill. Representative Dabney, does somebody want to move the bill?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I just go through the explanation. I can't move it.
It's best if you don't move it.
Do
you have copies of the bill?
What number was it?
1758. Related to access cards.
Mr. Chair, I'm not seeing it. I was leafing through several times. I'm not seeing it myself, Mr. Chair.
I don't either.
Representative Dabney, do you have a copy of it in front of you?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kalin, the challenge is that it has been amended in important ways after conversations with a number of the interested parties, and we want to represent it accurately.
Mr. Chair, Paige just handed me a copy. If Representative Dabney could look at it, and I know Representative Silver would be disappointed if we're actually double checking to make sure we're not using more forest products than
Representative
we need to. But
Representative Dabney, I think we'll try to do another bill because we can't really discuss it. I don't think while we
understood.
Don't have anything in front of us.
Let's figure out the best solution to this problem and as quick as possible.
Okay, thank you. Representative, is Walker? Okay, who's doing the last one? Abler's doing the last one, and he's doing his own. Okay. Where is Representative Abler? Representative Abler, I understand you're going to do the Lesh Bill 1577. Is that correct? Okay. Is this one we have?
How are you doing?
1577. It's near the members, it's near the back of the stack of papers.
Mr. Chair, can I tell me amendments in the packet for this bill?
I only found one, A4 amendment. Does somebody want to move Representative Gabler's bill? And is this
we're going to the general register? To the general register.
Representative Biggin moves House File 1577 to the general register for passage in. Correct. Okay, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
I think it's House File. I would be moving House File 1041 for passage.
No. Okay, we're on 1577.
Oh, okay.
This is the last one.
I was really confused there. I'm sorry. I'll move that one too, please.
Okay,
thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Representative Lester was called over. His deployment to Iraq was extended, and so he's over there doing that, I think.
part of
the surge effort there, Mr. Chair. He's helping out and doing his duty.
They so wanted him over there for the last time.
There is an amendment, but at least half of that amendment is very controversial and has not had much public notice and will extend your debate quite a long time. I don't know about the first part of the amendment, if it's necessary. Do you know what the first part is? Is that not Does anybody care about it? So he's tied together. That's what we can. So the amendment is
that. One amendment. Right.
While they're discussing it, is there any opposition to this bill?
That's the House amendment. Okay. Sir, do you have an amendment labeled A4 or what's
Yes, as I said about
5 minutes ago. Jerry Gerber from the Department of Human Services, and I think there's two different A4 amendments. There's one that's at 2:01 p.m., and there's one that's at 7 something.
I believe we just have the 7:51.
Okay.
Is that the correct
one? That's unfortunate. No.
That's not the right one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler does also have another bill before us.
The time stamp is 2:01 p.m.
2:49.
I've got a 7:51 a.m.
Let's do the other bill and we'll
why do we
see
have it all
in order to figure it out?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you for having me.
We will we will ignore the previous motion, and Bigham, Representative Bigham withdraws her prior motion. Representative Bigham moves House File 1041. Representative Abler. This one has an A4 amendment.
There's a little one.
At 2:49 p.m.
You're a wise guy, Mr. Chair. Do you have an amendment called the A4?
That's what I just said.
Sorry, I think this is a moving A4 amendment. I really
for a microphone. Hearing aid.
Mr. Chair, someone move the A4. Did you move the A4?
No, Representative Big moves the A4 amendment.
Thank you very much. I have 249 A4. Just to put the bill, just to modify the about how the driver's license is used, and we'll discuss the bill, but this will give some flexibility in the use of identification.
Representative Abler, Representative Bigham moves the A4 to get in the author, the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries.
Go ahead. Sure, one further oral amendment, if I may, and to delete section one.
I'm sorry, Representative.
Delete section one of the bill.
Okay. Representative Bigham moves to delete section one of the bill, which starts on page one and goes to the line five.
Page one.
Or
page one.
Oh.
You got that.
I'm Mr. Chair.
Once again, they don't give the chair the bills,
right? Sitting right in the front.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, it's dribbling over the front of your microphone.
Okay. Representative.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. What in the world is going on here? I mean, I've heard of making sausage, but Mr. Chair, you know, we got accused a couple of years ago of doing circus stuff, and I'm starting to think well, that's what we're
Representative.
Is there a first in growth? Because I don't have a first in growth.
Representative Coles,
I'm on my pile. I found it. Okay, I apologize.
There is a first engrossment, and the motion is to delete section one, which is all on the first page. So to get it in the shape the author wants, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No. Thank you.
I'll
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Let me just. I presume you're here for some of the privacy issues and so on, and we'll answer questions in a short time. This is the famous NASPER bill. The point of this is to try to crack down on both accidental and purposeful Schedule 2 and 3 narcotic use, and doing that by means of controlling some access, but also primarily allowing doctors to find out what kind of medications people have been taking relative to Schedule 2 and 3 narcotics before they give them more. This is a big problem, and I don't know how much witnesses you want to have, probably about none, but it's an issue. And so the design of this is to access some federal grant money to establish a working group, set up a website, and a method whereby these clinicians can call up. Either the methods to be determined as it's going to be an online or call-up method, and that would be in the working group's determination, to see exactly what the person has been taking lately. The data will be held 6 months, held by the Board of Pharmacy, in a secure place. The data is encrypted. The provider's data is encrypted so that it will not be known. That's a big issue to the Board of Medical Practice and the practicing physicians. The people will be informed as they're getting their Schedule 2 and 3 narcotic that they're likely to be put in this database, and at least that way they're notified. That would be one of the things we'd be talking about here, I suppose.
Ms. Erickson or
no, Casey from
or
that,
yeah.
Oh, well. Oh, yeah. Okay. Anyway, and so there's we've been since the bill has come in, it's been relatively controversial. Now it's hardly controversial at all. These to the pharmacists, the MDs, the home health people, the privacy people have still a few concerns. Law enforcement can only get the data if they have a court order or a search warrant. And the big thing to the providers was this does not allow, this will not be a tool to do fishing expeditions where they can look for providers who are doing the wrong thing, only by virtue of a bona fide criminal investigation and this data be accessed. And that's a real short summary, and if you want more, we got more, but maybe this Sergeant wants to offer one more thing.
Mr. Chairman, members, I did just want to make one point that this is, some of the committees are trying to figure out, like, if we're supposed to mandate everything of what this database would have at the moment. The point of this bill is to be able to apply for the federal planning grant that we can get through the Department of Justice right now. And so just want to make sure that some of the concerns that some members have had actually can't really be fully fixed at the point because we have to try and get the planning grant to figure out what would be the best way for Minnesota.
Okay, Representative Abler, I assume that you know this goes to finance. I was approached by the chair of Ways and Means
correct
this afternoon, and he said to go to health. Tell you that it had to go to finance committee.
Finance, I'm hoping to go to health finance after that.
Okay.
That's, we understand that.
Okay, is there any opposition to this? Okay, is there any discussion of this? Okay, then, all in favor, Representative Wiggum renews her motion to pass and go to the finance.
Mr. Chair, just before, I'm trying to understand what this bill does or doesn't do, and it sounds like all we're doing is setting up a system where we can go ask the feds for some money so that we can then set up a system. But Representative Abler, have you talked with Representative Holberg about this bill? I mean, it sounds like there are some data issues, and, you know, she's our, at least on our side of the aisle, she tends to kind of be our resident expert on data practice issues, and we're talking about holding information and making about individuals and making it accessible to others, maybe with or without their consent. I know that we don't fully know what it's going to look like yet, but have you had a conversation with Representative Holberg about this issue?
Representative Coles, actually, no, I haven't. I listen, I know he's been part of this. He would have and I'm not saying he's endorsing it, but he's been involved. We have not talked with him.
Okay, thank you.
Can, if you'd like. I think that would probably be a good idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just as it goes to the final.
Thank you. You are on the same side of the aisle. Okay.
I'll put my motion on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bigham. All in favor of Representative Bigham's motion to send it to finance, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is the other one, I think
you have
people
the
have the... What do we have that
I have to check in on finance, Mr. Chair, so good luck. I have some fun, guys. Pass whatever you want to pass.
No roll call.
Roll call.
Okay. Is this
Representative Abler, do you have the delete all universal health care amendment ready?
Yeah. Are you ready for that? And now the real bill we're going.
Where did my department go? Representative Abler. And yeah, but this is
This is going to continue.
Sure.
No, this is just a regular general register.
Okay.
I was the one kidding about it. I was
asked. Just checking.
Okay, Representative Abler, I guess, do people have the A4 that's dated 2:01 p.m.?
Yes, sir.
For House File 1577.
Everybody except the chair. The first one. They gave us a pass.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1577 so we can at least have the bill before us.
Thank you. Representative Kalin moves House File 1577 and...
Mr. Chair, if someone wants to move Section 1 of Amendment 8-4, well, that would be awesome.
Just... where does that go?
Page one lines 1 through 9.
This is for the
And what was the...
Mr. Chair, would, Representative Abler, is your intention to only offer lines 1.4 to 1.8, is that correct, of the A4 amendment?
We're not going to come
1.2
to
1.4.
Yeah,
1.2 to 1.4. Mr. Chair, I will delete lines 1.9 to the end of the A4 amendment, incorporate that motion into my amendment, and I will then move the A4 amendment, which leaves only lines 1.2 to 1.8.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. And that, my understanding is the author wants that. So this is to put it in the shape the author wants.
Oh, we can describe it for if you want. Or
no.
Okay.
We'll put it in the shape you want.
The shape I want it. That's right.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, from my understanding, you hear about the data privacy and such matters, but maybe the department staff who's here can review the bill with regard to those items. That would be good.
Okay, go ahead. State your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Plummer-Zerust, and I'm a manager with the licensing division at the Department of Human Services.
Okay.
And ahead. I'll just review the data practices provisions.
Okay.
There, in the licensing bill in Article 1, there is one data practices provision, and that amends Section 13.46, Subdivision 4. That's our licensing data piece of the welfare data provision of the Data Practices Act. And what this provision does is it makes the same data public for applicants for a license as it's public for license holders that currently have a license under the Data Practices Act for purposes of licensing data. And it also, the other amendment to this section addresses concerns that were expressed regarding child foster care license holders, and it's been brought to our attention that in some cases it may not be in the best interest of children in placement to have data giving the address, for example, of the license holder's home as public data. So in those cases, if the county attorney were to advise us that best interest of the children were of concern in those cases, that data would not then be public data. That's the only data practices provision in the licensing bill. And then under Article 1, then there are data practices provisions under Article 2 that I'll turn to. And there are two provisions under Article 2 that address sharing data between the agencies. The first has to do with sharing data between the Department of Human Services and DEED, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And in terms of this one, in 2005, DHS was awarded a four-year Comprehensive Employment Medicaid Infrastructure Grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. The grants fund a collaborative effort between DHS, DEED, and the Minnesota State Council on Disability to build an infrastructure that will increase and sustain the employment rate and earnings of people with disabilities. The existing data collection system and analysis structures are not sufficiently coordinated across the agencies. So the proposed change will allow DHS and DEED to exchange certain individual and employer-level data on clients currently participating in DHS and DEED programs for the purposes of analyzing programs, processes, and outcomes such as service utilization, program costs, and program effectiveness. And then the other data practices amendment under Article 2 has to do with parental fees. And what that does is it allows the Department of Human Services and the Department of Revenue to exchange data relating to, for purposes of calculating the parental fee, namely adjusted gross income data, for purposes of calculating that fee. Right now what happens is if the parents, you know, they're asked to provide that information, but if it's not forthcoming, then they're assessed the entire fee, and then it later has to be adjusted, which causes accounting types of issues. Those are the data practices provisions.
Okay, and Mr. Kerver, did you have something, or are you to answer questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm just here to answer questions. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, this is too late to be in our omnibus, so we'll have to go to the general register.
That was the plan.
Okay. Okay, is there any discussion of this bill?
Kind of like the ark, once the door closes, you can't get in.
Well, there are substantive amendments.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, same question. I know it's not your bill. I know you're here for Representative Lesch, but do you know if anybody's chatted with either Representative Holberg or Representative Simon, who I know is carrying the data practices bill, about the provisions contained here that apparently are not going to be in the omnibus bill? I'm seeing blank stares, Mr. Chair. I don't know if that is a no. Representative Abler, could you please ask Representative Lesch, I'll try to do it myself, but could you please ask Representative Lesch to have a conversation with Representative Simon and Representative Holberg about those provisions? I'm fine moving this out of here tonight, but I do expect that they will have a look at this and have the ability to have some input on it if they have some concerns.
Oh, reasonable. That's certainly, and I think you should take that under advisement. Okay, all in favor?
Sorry, go ahead. Proceed, Mr. Chair. I'll renew my motion to make sure that we have it, that the 1577 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Correct.
Yes. Sorry about that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Carries.
Thanks for having me, Mr. Chair, and our guests. We appreciate the time.
Okay. Do we have the Daphne? Do we have the system? Does everybody have this small 8.5 by 11? Post committee of growth from 1758. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
this is one we don't have, right?
Mr. Chair, I apologize for the early inconvenience. I knew the committee did not have the bill in their possession, but I didn't think they really didn't have the bill in their possession.
Okay. So, Representative Dabney, just go ahead and explain the bill that we should be having. Hopefully, they're processing it. And we will have it eventually.
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping by tomorrow afternoon. Members, House File 1758 deals with this, with an access card. Most of us think of it as a credit card, but for the terms of this bill, it's an access card. And it responds to concerns that have been brought to me over the last several years by the credit union network. It's another positive step in securing consumers' right to the privacy of their data in retail transactions. The concern is this. When you pay for a good or service at a retail shop and use your credit card, the retailer accesses the data on the card that's necessary to process the transaction. Good so far, no problem. The challenge is some retailers, in violation of their agreement with Visa and MasterCard, retain some of the critical elements of that data, PIN numbers, the magnetic stripe data, and that special little three-digit number on the back is particularly critical. The concern becomes, and the fact of and the incidents happen where retailers are holding on to that data or the third-party services that they use, holding on to that data in violation of their agreement, that data is then breached. For the consumer, that's a challenge. Representative Coles and I worked on that together quite a bit last year and were very successful in that. For the financial institution, however, it's a different problem. They now have to contact, because of our work, their members and notify them of the breach. They also have to go through the expense of replacing the cards and the inconvenience for both the consumer and the institution. The problem for the institution, particularly beyond the cost and the inconvenience, is that the member often blames the institution for the breach when in fact the breach was someplace else. And the Visa agreement that the institution has signed prohibits them from identifying where the breach was. House File 1758 simply puts into state law prohibitions on retailers retaining that essential information beyond the transaction. With me tonight is Ms. Dana Hoffman Guy from the
Ms. Guy. Oh. Well, all former neighbor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dana Hoffman-Guy. I'm the General Counsel of the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and I'm available to answer any questions that you have about any of the provisions of this bill or any of the security standards upon which we base the provisions.
So, Representative Dabney, this helps the financial institutions, banks, and things like that?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Have you gone to the dark side?
Any other questions?
Did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I think I like your bill. I haven't...
You've got overnight to reconsider, Representative.
Representative Dabney, where are the retailers at? I don't know if I was
right behind you.
I guess I don't know if Mr. Anderson is planning to testify or not, but.
He is nodding, yes.
All right, well...
He has before.
I'll wait and hear what Mr. Anderson has to say before I ask
him.
I'm sure
he's here for a reason. Are you done with yours? So do I need to put Mr. Anderson?
Certainly.
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of Minnesota Retailers, and... Mr. Chair, I'm not your former neighbor. I hope that's okay. Does that count against me in any way?
No, at one time before you went to the dark side, you were a member of our caucus.
So I should get some points, I guess. Mr. Chair, members, thanks for giving me an opportunity to talk about this bill, and I want to thank Representative Dabney for working with us. This bill was introduced relatively late, and it's gotten a lot of hearings very quickly, and it's one of those kinds of issues that's really tough to get up on, to get up to speed on, because it's rather a complicated issue. We as retailers have no problem if you prohibit us from keeping PIN numbers, all the information on the magnetic strip, or the security number that's on the back, because we're prohibited by Visa and MasterCard from doing that now. So, you know, if you want to put it in the statute that we can't do that, that's just fine. I mentioned at a committee last night that one of my members, a reputable Minnesota company that has been in business since 1895 in this state, still a family-owned business, was a victim of identity theft themselves, and 40 credit card numbers were pilfered from their file, and they were fined $400,000 by Visa and MasterCard. So Visa and MasterCard take this very seriously, and I might point out that was not a hearing. It was like a call on Tuesday. We're deducting $400,000 from your account. That's how judicious they are, and there's no arguing with that. So they are very, very strict about how they enforce these rules. But I guess the point I want to make is that there are some potential problems here in terms of we're not able to retain the PIN information. I think we do. As a result of the way we process with MasterCard and Visa, retain the PIN number for a while, and I'm still trying to figure out how that works. And I've made several calls today, and I'm getting closer to an answer. So, and I'm sure Representative Davity is not trying to prevent normal transactions from taking place in the marketplace. So, you know, we'll get that part figured out. There's also a question like, and I just brought this up to some of the other folks today, this mentions a store value card. And I don't know if that means a gift card or if that means a bank debit card or if it's defined in statute, but we have to figure that out too because I don't think we're talking about gift cards in this. The last thing I want to mention is if you get all the way down to subdivision 3, essentially we don't have much problem with the bill. The only part we have a problem with is the liability and the remedies in the bill. And the reason it's a problem is I called the Insurance Federation today. They looked at it and said, you know, I think we're creating an uninsurable risk for retailers here. And I doubt if that's really Representative Dabney's intent. I don't think. So he's agreed, and the folks in the credit unions have agreed to continue to work with us to try to find some remedy which still allows people to recover their losses if a retailer does make one of these errors, but one that doesn't create an uninsurable risk. So I'll try to have that language or some version that's more acceptable by the next time we meet, and I assume that will be tomorrow, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Anderson, we hope we can fit it in. Yeah, we're backed up, so it's a real problem because of what happened last night. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gavney, as I've now had a chance to read through the bill as we're talking about it, and I'll try to track you down tomorrow. Just a couple of issues as I look at the remedy section, page 2, line 28 to the end of the page there. The remedies include, you indicate that the court shall award, and then in part 2 there, reasonable attorney's fees. And I tend to just have a problem, and I just highlight it because these are the issues I'm going to want to talk to you about. I tend to have a problem with shall award attorney's fees. I know it exists in statute and other places. I get concerned. I mean, we generally operate under the American rule where each side pays their own attorney's fees. I understand in some of these situations the court can and often does award attorney's fees. So I raise that point. And then the other question I have is in paragraph B, the language about a private right of action by a borrower under this chapter is in the public interest. I'm not sure why that language is there and what it means. If you could address that now, if you can.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, two responses to the two issues you raised. On the issue of reasonable attorney's fees, while I tend historically to have thought of financial institutions as large, monolithic, impersonal organizations, some of these, particularly the credit unions, can be quite small, the employees of a single company or things like that. For them, the cost of having to replace the cards of members, whether it's 10 cards or several hundred cards, can be a significant cost for them to then engage in the court action in order to recoup that loss if they don't have an assurance of receiving their attorney's fees back from the court action. That's yet another barrier for them to return reclaiming those losses. So I think that's the rationale behind the shall on attorney's fees. As to the your concerns about 8.31, my understanding is that historically, the conceptual basis behind 8.31 is that the individual is acting in the public interest. That's where the granting of that right comes from. But court decisions around the country have narrowed that and require some level of, have put a barrier for individuals or entities using 8.31. And so that is comfort language to assure people that they have access to those rights.
Mr. Chair, just very briefly, and then we can move on. I appreciate that, Representative Abney, and I believe I'm familiar with some of those court decisions, but I don't know that every action brought in a situation like this is necessarily in the public interest. If you have a dispute between two businesses, and it happens to be a dispute related to something like this, it may or may not be in the broader public interest. And so I guess that's where my concern is. I'll talk to you about it a little more tomorrow. And I may or may not have an amendment regarding that when the bill is passed out officially in front of us. But I appreciate the dialogue. And that's just kind of where I want to come out. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Sorry, Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cole's brief response. I think we've all agreed, the retailers, and Mr. Anderson can correct me if I'm wrong, as well as others, that we need retailers not to be holding on to this data in violation of the agreement. So I think there is a public interest in ensuring consumers and financial institutions that retailers are not inappropriately retaining that data.
Representative Coles, I think, I don't know if you've handled these consumer cases under 8.31, the private attorney general statute that applies to the 325 cases.
And not for a long time, I'm a recovery lawyer.
Okay. Well, I handled some of those, and the Shell Award, actually, it does require award of attorney's fees. However, I believe, I think it was the Love the Ambler case in the late 80s that pointed out how effective that is, because they went up to the court refused to allow any attorney's fees, to the winner under a 325F case. And so they went to the appellate court, and the appellate court says you have to give attorney's fees. That went back assigned to the district court, and as I recall, they gave like $300 or something like that. And I've had judges that did this. They said, well, we're not going to give any attorney's fees. You can appeal it if you want, and then comes back, and I'll give you maybe a couple $100. So the shell doesn't really mean much when you get into the court system. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Cole and Representative Dabney, our concern actually starts way back when you talk about the liability, and it's got notwithstanding any other provisions. I mean, that tends to open up a can of worms. And I'm not a lawyer, but I know that tends to, create some other potential problems. And then you have, as you pointed out, the verbiage in the public interest, which, again, was pointed out to me today, could be problematic in terms of making this an uninsurable risk. In addition, the point number two, when you're talking about reasonable attorney fees, not to mention one, which is actual, incidental, and consequential damages, which is sort of open-ended too, all to be interpreted by the court. So again, I think that's probably what makes it an uninsurable risk, and we're trying to narrow this down so that we aren't putting onto retailers a burden that could be so incredible that they can't insure for it, when in fact they might be victims of identity theft themselves, as some have been. I would also say this. Visa and MasterCard, again, don't allow us to retain this data, but as business people and as retailers, we have to take credit card. If we don't take credit cards, we can't do business. But the biggest hammer they have is to take away our right to use credit cards. So if we violate their standards, they can take away our ability to use credit cards. That's the worst thing that can happen to us, given any other penalties in law. So, again, I'm just trying to bring some balance to that, and I hope to be able to work with the author, Representative Coles, and others to find that balance.
Okay. No further questions. Okay. Then we're just doing nothing with it. We'll cogitate overnight on this.
There we go. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
we're not going to get there. Well, Representative Mason, then you're next. And again, we don't have the bill. So we'll be doing
copies of
A&A. We've got copies, but we don't have the bill, so we can't act on it. We're just doing an information hearing.
Oh, okay.
So
just proceed with what we're
doing. Yes, you were in the committee last night that didn't do their reports. So we have to deal with it as we can. So nobody will move your bill or anything. We'll just take the testimony, and there'll be discussion, and then when we get the bill, we'll try to find time to vote on it.
Okay, I appreciate
it. If we have time this week. So go ahead. Is it in front of everybody? Is this the 635? Okay, everybody has it now.
Okay, 635 and 634 is being printed, so as soon as it gets here, you'll have the bill numbers.
So what's being printed?
The DE-4 is the one that was actually discussed last night.
People, is that a delete off? We do not have that, right? Nobody's got that represented.
Okay. Would it make a difference? I mean, basically, what we're here is to just focus on the penalties, and we just go ahead and deal with that.
The members of this committee tend to go beyond that.
Okay.
So what we'll have to do is, sorry, but you're going to have to
wait till
that's printed, and we'll take Representative Walker. Hopefully, we have your bill. Hopefully.
Okay.
We do. Okay, Representative Walker, and we actually not only have copies of it, we actually have your bill in our possession.
Yes, thank you, Chair.
Representative Walker, I believe, does this go to finance?
This is going to help. It's going to finance.
It's going to finance. Yes. Okay. Does somebody want to move Representative Walker's bill? Representative Olin moves House File 1169 for passage and referral to Finance Committee. Representative Walker, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. To stay on time, I'm actually going to have Aaron Sullivan Sutton go through the Article 1 that's in your preview for the committee.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members.
State your name.
My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Director of the Division of Child Safety and Permanency for the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. This bill deals with children who are in foster care and children who are in need of adoption. And there are a number of provisions that I will go through with you that are related to the purview of this committee. The first of which is on page 8. Sections 2, 6, and 20 of the bill deal with situations involving children who are 14 years of age or older and are wards of the state. That means there's been a termination of parental rights. Under current law, those children can sign an affidavit saying that they don't want to be adopted, and they also have an opportunity to consent to adoption. These provisions would make it clear that the agency has continued responsibility to find a permanent family for those children, and the children would be on the adoption state adoption exchange. But the children would still have the opportunity to consent to a particular adoption, so that would not be forced upon them. But it assures that efforts are continuing to find that appropriate for the child. Section 3 and 4 of the bill simply deal with the point in time at which the court administrator's office sends the department petitions for adoption and decrees of adoption for purposes of record keeping. Section 6, as I said, deals again with the 14-year-old. Section 7 of the bill deals with situations where children are either entering Minnesota or leaving Minnesota for purposes of foster care or adoption. This past fall, Congress passed what's called the Safe and Timely Placement Act. That requires a number of provisions to assure, and in this instance, that counties consider both placements inside Minnesota as well as placements in other states for purposes of permanency. Section 8 of the bill provides clarification regarding the definition of an Indian tribe, which is consistent with federal law. Section 9 of the bill provides clarification of the definition of a tribal court to ensure that it's consistent with federal law, that the tribal court does not need to be federally recognized. Section 10 and 11 require that agencies make active efforts to identify and locate extended family members when working with Indian children for purposes of placement, and that's consistent with other requirements for active efforts in the case involving Indian children. Section 12 of the bill clarifies that a child does not need to live on the clarifies that a child tribe has jurisdiction for a child residing or domiciled on the reservation. Section 13 of the bill clarifies the application of the Indian Child Welfare Act to any custody proceeding involving an Indian child, whether or not the child was raised as part of an Indian family or a contract with the tribe. The federal law that was passed by Congress in 1978 makes it very clear that the Indian Child Welfare Act is to apply to all children who are enrolled in tribes or are eligible for involvement, and this is consistent with that. Section 14 of the bill again addresses the issue of interstate placement of children and conforms the requirements of Minnesota law to be consistent with the new federal requirements. There are provisions in that section regarding conducting home studies within 50 days of request and allowing for extensions to 75 days if needed in certain situations. I should note that the a law does not provide any funding, so this is additional working time for some counties, but they are aware of that and not projected. This also provides language regarding receipt of incentive funds if they are available. Section 15 of the bill provides foster parents, pre-adoptive parents, and relative caregivers with the right to be heard as part of any hearing involving children in this care. Under previous law, they were to be given an opportunity to be heard, but under the new federal changes, they're to be given a right to be heard. Section 16 of the bill is another federal requirement and requires that in any permanency hearing, the court is to ensure that the child is consulted with in an age-appropriate manner so that the child's voice is heard. Section 17 of the bill provides clarification regarding trial home visits. A couple of years ago, you passed legislation that allowed for trial home visits, and that the trial home visit was not considered as part of the time frame for determining permanency. The federal law has changed, and that time frame now has to count towards what we call the permanency time clock. The section also makes it clear that the permanency hearing is held at the time the child is in a trial home visit, the court can continue that.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, are all of these in the purview of our committee, or?
Just the ones I'm going over.
Oh, okay. Okay. Go ahead.
And section 20, again, it deals with the 14-year-old who is a state ward. And Mr. Chair, you were saying we'll get back again.
That's him? Oh,
yeah.
Good. Is there any questions on this bill? Any questions on this bill? Okay, then Representative Olin renews his motion for passage and referral to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
You have Representative Mason's agenda? Okay. Representative Mason, back to the chair. Representative Mason, I will start over again. This is the DD 4 amendment dated, or time 5:40 p.m., is that correct? They all seem to be DD 4 tonight. This is delete everything. Representative Mason, why don't you go ahead and explain your bill?
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Just, Representative Mason, just wanted to see, is there opponents to this bill? One? Nobody else? Okay. Let's say that we'll give each side 7 minutes. Then. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. And I want to thank both the Attorney General's office and the representatives from the carriers for all the work that they have done to bring the bill this far. The bill has been through three committees so far. This is a basic consumer protection bill coming out of the Attorney General's office. My understanding that the focus of this committee was going to be on the penalties, so I am going to turn it over to Jessica Palmer Denick to focus on those issues.
Palmer Denick?
Palmer Denick, yes, the hyphen in the middle.
Okay. Go ahead.
My name is Jessica Palmer Denning. I'm with the Attorney General's Office. I manage the Residential and Small Business Utilities Division of the office. It's the area of the office that focuses on both regulated utilities, including telecommunications and energy, and also wireless issues. This bill is actually designed to replace some legislation that was passed by this legislature and signed by the governor in 2004. That was a wireless consumer protection measure. And while the AG's office has taken up this issue this session, the 2004 bill was actually a Republican-led effort championed by Representative now Senator Van Veer in the House and Senator Bachman in the Senate. So we see this not as a partisan bill at all, but as a real bipartisan issue. The statute that was passed in 2004 was challenged in court by the wireless industry and went through a lot of litigation over several years, including an appeal to the United States Supreme Court, but ultimately the bill was, the legislation was struck down and it was actually never effective. That legislation was designed to protect consumers from unauthorized extensions of their contract without their consent, and also price changes without their consent, and that was really the contentious issue in the litigation, because the courts eventually found that that was rate regulation, which is prohibited to the states by federal law. The main focus of this bill is on disclosure. It requires some fairly minimal contracting standards, that the consumers be given an accurate coverage map, that they know how much their service is going to cost, that they be given a copy of their contract. It also addresses some continuing issues that the Attorney General's office has seen about extensions of contract length without notice or consent to consumers, and also unauthorized third-party charges that are placed on wireless bills. There's currently a provision in Minnesota law that prevents local telephone carriers from placing unauthorized charges on your local telephone bill, so we wanted to extend that same kind of protection to wireless customers. With respect to the enforcement provisions of the bill, which is something that hasn't gotten as much attention in its three other stops in committee, the bill envisions the enactment of a consumer protection law, which will be enforced by the Attorney General's office under Section 8.31, its general enforcement authority. I did a quick search, not exhaustive, but just quick, of other kinds of legislation that currently exist that cover contracting, general disclosure provisions that are also enforced by the Attorney General's office. And not to go through all of them, and again, my list is not exhaustive, but it includes things like home solicitation sales, prize notices and solicitations, actually automatic garage door opening systems, which I was surprised to see, membership travel contracts, disclosures of videotape rental or sales records, and credit card contract disclosures. That one is particularly applicable because that provision requires a certain disclosures, that they be in certain size type fonts, and that they be some of them in boldface, and these were things that were considered for this legislation. There are many other statutes that make violation of that statute an unlawful practice under the Attorney General's office's authority and 325F.69. For instance, in the telecommunications context, slamming when a long-distance provider is changed without your consent, that's considered to be consumer fraud. I want to also emphasize that the Attorney General's office's practice is not to just sue people. We do try to mediate disputes with wireless carriers. We receive lots of complaints about them. We do go to the wireless carriers with respect to every single complaint we receive in an attempt to negotiate the complaint to get a good result for the consumer. But having these enforcement tools in our tool chest would definitely make it easier to ensure that consumers get the disclosures that we think that they should get. So with that, I can certainly answer any questions.
Okay. Then the opponents.
Good evening, Chairman Mallory and members of the committee. My name is Juanita Brown, and I am Regional Vice President for Legislative and Regulatory Affairs for AT&T. AT&T, singular as you may think of us in the wireless world, opposes House File 635. We do appreciate the opportunity that we have been given by the Attorney General's Office and Representative Mason in working together and trying to minimize our concerns. But at the end of the day, we are concerned that regulation on a state basis for wireless carriers, and we maintain, is inappropriate. Specifically tonight, we're here to, as I understood it also, to talk about the penalty provisions of this bill. There are many provisions that we still have major concerns on, but I do not intend to address those this evening. Basically, as Ms. Palmer-Denig said, this bill deals with wireless disclosure requirements and third-party billing regulations. AT&T believes that the application of Section 8.31 is an inappropriate penalty provision for when we do not disclose certain items that are required under this bill. An example of that would be is if a customer came into one of our stores and we, in this bill, we are required to provide them a map. If we did not provide them a map and they walked out our door, then they could come back after us and look for a penalty of up to $25,000 for one of our employees just failing to provide a piece of paper to the customer. And we do not believe that's appropriate. Now, we do believe that penalties, there should be some type of penalty provisions in there. And so we really took a look at what other penalty provisions are out there. And what we found is that on the wireline world, where you have your hardline wired phone, that there are disclosure rules out there, and the penalty provisions for those are not 8.31. They're much less. They're not $25,000 if they don't provide a piece of paper to a customer. And so we would urge the committee to look at those other provisions and modify this bill and not implement 8.31 on wireless carriers. I would stand open for questions.
Okay, I'll start out with a question.
Okay.
Number one is, my understanding is that that would go to a court to determine what the penalty would be, and I think it's up to $25,000.
That is correct.
And do you have any idea how often the court gives $25,000 for a piece of paper not given under 8.31 or under any of the 325 statutes?
I do not.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as to if there is a disconnection penalty on your hard line at home, like there is if you decide to quit your cell phone contract early.
Ms. Brown.
Chairman, members of the committee, I am not aware of a term. I think you're referring to the early termination fees. And the difference between a hardwired phone and cellular service is we provide discounts to the equipment for our wireless service. And so it's those discounts that you're receiving on pieces of equipment that we're trying to recover through those early termination fees. And on the wired service, we no longer provide equipment. And so that's why there's that difference between the two technologies.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one of my concerns is I've been a cell phone user for a very long time. I was with Quest first for 5 or 6 years, and now I'm with T-Mobile and have been for a couple of years. And we have 5 cell phones in our home, and so I am an avid cell phone user.
We appreciate that business. Our industry does. I hope you're with us.
Absolutely. My concern is one of the reasons why the penalty, I think, that's being proposed is higher is because if you don't give me a map or you don't tell me where my cell phone service is going to be and I get at home and find out that, you know, my cell phone doesn't work in my house but it works at my mom's house, you know, down the block, or it works at the cabin or it doesn't work at the cabin, then I can't cancel my contract with you without having a significant penalty. So, I mean, that's what I see as part of the problem being an avid cell phone user. And I changed companies actually because of service connections. When I was sitting on the Capitol, at the Capitol on my house floor, in my house floor chair, if I turned my head to the left, I had service. If I turned it to the right, I didn't have cell phone service. And so, you know, what good did it do me? So.
Ms. Brown.
Thank you. In response to that, I just have a couple comments. First, on behalf of Singular AT&T, we do have a 30-day return policy where if you enter into a contract, and we do that just for the instances that you describe, so that if a customer goes home after we've shown them their maps, because this proposed legislation requires before you ever enter into a contract that a map has to be provided and we have to give you that information beforehand. And what I'm concerned about is that in addition, then after you have seen that map, you've made your purchasing decision, I still have to provide, under this rule or this law, I would have to provide you a copy of that map, which, you know, probably 99% of the time that will happen. But everyone's human, and sometimes somebody might walk out the door without that map. And so hopefully, you know, that's the concern I have, is that you really, we provide maps, we give you that information, we have a liberal return policy, so that instances, if you get home and you cannot have your service work, you can return it. There are no early termination fees that we apply.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do all of the companies have that same liberal return policy, or is that just you?
I cannot answer that. I cannot talk on behalf of the rest of the companies, because I'll be honest, I am fairly new to the wireless industry, but I've learned about our company's processes, and so I'm sorry.
Representative Olin, and before that, Mr. Magnolia, we're trying to keep the audience should come up to first. Mr. Magnolia is brand new to just been here a couple of days.
There is a voluntary code of assurance that 33 states have entered into, their attorney generals have entered into, and under that, there is a 14-day, all carriers are required to have a 14-day minimum return policy, and even though the attorney general here in the state of Minnesota has not agreed and entered into that assurance of voluntary compliance, those are being applied nationally.
OK. Okay, Representative Olin, and then...
Yeah, I'm only going to make a quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The quick comment is, from the experiences my daughter has had, I can truthfully say that there needs to be something badly done. She's had it through three different companies, and she's had problems. They all didn't give any money back, cost me additional months to pay for.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just comment. Looks to me like a real fair and balanced bill that reflects your basic best practices of businesses. Appreciate Mason working on it as hard as she has and bringing it forward to us.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mason. I like the bill, and I do understand the concern that Ms. Brown is bringing, but having I live in a very one of the fastest growing counties in the upper Midwest, and we have been dealing with the 1996 Telecommunications Act provisions for 10 years, and I can tell you that it is not very difficult to site a cell phone tower. In fact, it is very easy, and there are very few ways that a community can prevent a cell phone tower, a cellular repeater or an actual full tower from being built in your community. And so I had the concern about reading the bill and saying, is the remedy, the appropriate scale of remedy for not having accurate coverage maps? And in my community, I live along the St. Croix River Valley, where we do have pretty deep valleys, and I have a couple of communities that are right along the river, and so we have bluff line issues, and all this has been resolved because of the 1996 Telecommunications Act and because of the competition in the market. I just wanted to raise those issues just to state that as I was thinking through the bill and looking at and understanding the a lot of work that Representative Mason and many others have put in, and including the industry, that I do think that it is, looking at the whole picture, that it is a fair and balanced bill. I hope that folks won't come and make consumer decisions based on where a red blob extends, and against the border of a community or something like that. I think people are wise enough to ask those questions, and so therefore the piece of paper becomes less important than the actual representation through the conversation with the agents. But do appreciate your input, but I think the bill's headed in the right direction.
Representative
Paul. Chair, thank you. First, I'd note for Representative Hillstrom, the retiring room has great reception, and the speaker always admonishes us to take our conversations off the floor, so try the retiring room next time. It works for me great in terms of cell phone coverage. So, Ms. Brown, a question for you, Mr. Chair, if I could. The required disclosures here, Ms. Brown, is your company already doing those? Is there anything here that your company's not doing already?
Ms. Brown?
The one item that we are going to have concerns with that would make us modify our systems today is our terms and conditions that we provide customers, and I have one of them back here I could show you. It is in the terms specifically when you go to page 2 of the bill, line 6 through 10, where it talks about 12-point font in written materials. Our font is 10-point font, although when we talked to the Attorney General and we talked to Representative Mason, originally when we showed them our font, we all thought it was 10. We thought it was that 12-point font, but when we went back to our folks, because of the different types of print styles that you can select, again, the 12-point font, ours is 10-point. It will cause us to modify our literature to operate in the state of Minnesota, which will indeed then increase our cost to do business and therefore consumer prices potentially here in the state of Minnesota. So that's one of our concerns.
Mr. Chair, just really quickly, and then Ms. Brown, what I understand you saying is that you might have to change the font size, and I understand operationally that poses some challenges. But other than that, I mean, the disclosures that are required here are something that at least your company is already doing. Is that correct?
Yes. Many of the items that are contained in this bill are items that we are doing today. Our biggest concern about advancing state legislation is the technology in our industry is changing dramatically, and will we be putting in writing something today that will limit our ability to provide teacher services here in the state of Minnesota? And that's really our concern about implementing this bill.
Mr. Chair, if I could, a question for Ms. Palmer-Denning. For Ms. Palmer-Denning. Am I pronouncing your name right now?
Denning.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Palmer-Denning, I've chatted with a few other folks who I know have had some questions in previous committees about you know, kind of what's behind this bill, and you know, where are the complaints? What are the complaints? And I know there have been some requests in the past from other members. You know, what kind of complaints is the Attorney General's office getting in terms of aggregate data? I know you can't provide data on individuals. I'm not asking you to do that, but I mean, what kind of complaints is the Attorney General's office getting in terms of volume that this bill, you believe, would address?
Ms. Paul,
sure, I can answer that. And we've had some difficulty. The Data Practices Act, of course, provides some things about the Attorney General's office consumer complaint data, and we've been we're very serious about those provisions, and so we've tried to be very careful about it. I can tell you that we got in 2004 and 2005 about 1,000 complaints a year from Minnesota consumers about the wireless industry. During those years, it represented about 30%, 25 to 35% of the complaints that the AG's office received about regulated utilities generally, and I'm lumping wireless in with that, even though they're actually not a regulated utility. So telecommunications, energy, and wireless. We'd be looking at about 25 to 35% of our complaints were about the wireless industry. Interestingly, in 2003, which is the year preceding the year that this legislature adopted the prior statute, we actually had about 40% fewer complaints about the wireless industry. We saw a spike after the 2004 legislation was passed, and in 2005. We had a very slight dip in 2006, but we're still above our 2003 complaint levels. And so far this year, we're on you know, if the projection stays the same as it has been so far, about a quarter to 30% of our complaints are about the wireless industry.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Palmer-Denning, I think my question is a little more precise than that, and it really is, how many of those complaints are related, not wireless industry complaints in general, because I don't think that this bill is going to respond to all of the complaints that I'm sure your office, I know your office gets. So how many of those complaints are the type of issues addressed by this bill, the disclosure type issues, mm-hmm. the map issues, the, you know, not providing a disclosure that the contract price can change.
Mm-hmm.
Can you provide me some context around that?
I apologize that I don't have hard data numbers on the breakdown of the different kinds of complaints. I can say that this bill is addressed to the top areas of complaints that the office has seen, things like people saying that they were told that service would work in a particular area and the map showed that it would and then it did not, things like contract extensions without consent, third-party charges on wireless bills. The contract extensions issue was a very big deal in the 2004 legislation, and it continues to be a substantial complaint generator. I work in this area all the time, and so I talk to consumers a lot, and I have a general sense about what those issues are, and the fact that we saw the same problems in 2003, 2004, and we're still seeing those same problems in 2007 now is what led us to believe that this was still necessary legislation.
Mr. Chair, one last request. Ms. Palmer-Denning, I'm hoping you can get us some of that information, because I mean, we are talking about significant penalties, and I don't have a problem. If Minnesota law says you got to do something, I don't have a problem going after a company if they don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think that's your the Attorney General's office's job, and I think you ought to do it. But I mean, there are some significant potential penalties here.
Mm-hmm.
I think the chairman's right that we're probably not going to get a $25,000 fine every time somebody doesn't have one piece of paper. But nonetheless, there are significant potential penalties here, and I want to make sure that what we're putting into the statute books is meaningful, and it's not just it's not just something that feels good to do. And so, can you provide us between now and I know the bill is going to be back here to be formally acted upon? Can you give us some information about how many of those complaints actually would be addressed by this piece of legislation?
Unfortunately, the data doesn't exist in raw form in our office in that way. Right now, we can manipulate the data and create the summary data under the Data Practices Act that we would be allowed to produce. We are working to try to get some of that data produced, and I can hopefully provide some approximate numbers. And I know the Attorney General was interested in providing some written responses to all of the chairs of the committees for distribution on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Holligan.
We'll see. No further questions or discussion, and we will not take any action on this bill tonight. Hopefully, we'll have it tomorrow. Thank you, Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Representative Coles, my understanding is you're going to move to the minutes of the 8th and the 13th.
Yes. Mr. Chair, first of all, a big thank you to Ms. Benson for putting the minutes together. It looks like particularly there was one date, March 8th, where we had a whole bunch of roll calls, and I think she captured those correctly. I did note, and I shared with Ms. Benson, and I think Mr. Bearden, there was one slight typo
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, March 15th, page 2.
With that typo that I know Ms. Benson has simply changed moves to moved, Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes of Thursday, March 8th, Tuesday, March 13th, and Thursday, March 15th.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Careful.
No. Okay. No. Okay, we're doing the minutes.
Members, we're going to proceed to Chairman Mullery's bill, House File 2229. Just a quick status check with everybody. And no, that doesn't mean bring out your driver's licenses. We are making sure that we have copies of House File 1824 physically, and so those are being taken care of. And then I believe we will be taking up Representative Dabney's bill and then returning to Chairman Mullery's House File 931. So now that Chairman Mullery is at the testifier's table, would you like to move House File 2229?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move House File 2229 for layover and possible inclusion in the prime omnibus.
Excellent. We have the bill before us now, Chairman Mullery, excuse me. And do you have an amendment?
Yes, we do.
Would you like to distribute that amendment while you're discussing it?
Mr. Chairman and members, it's the A2 amendment, dated 7:32 p.m. tonight. And I would move that.
Chairman Mullery moves the A2 amendment, but it's currently being distributed. So perhaps you want to just speak to the bill generally first, and then we'll have an amendment before us.
That's fine.
Chair Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is an ignition interlock program that would be a pilot program, and I believe there's going to be federal funding for it. It's on the issue of DWI and people who are under DWIs. And this is something that I became interested in many years ago, and a always tried to get the state to go further because I think a lot of people get DWIs but don't really intend to commit violations of the law, and this would really help them in keeping away from going out and driving while intoxicated. I think it's a really great idea, and I'm glad to see that that we have this going. But this was Senator Latz came with this bill, and we have Lynn, I believe Lynn Galger from MAD, and she could explain the bill, and then we have Ms. McCormick from the agency.
Thank you very much, Chair Mulder. I believe before we go to testimony, does everyone have the 8.5 by 11 A2 amendment before them? And perhaps I don't believe that that we have an electronic form of this. So if you could describe the amendment quickly, Chair Mulder.
I have to. I believe it's from. Yes.
Chair Mulder, staff is telling me that this amendment is just to line up with the bill as it's moving through the other body. Is that correct?
That's what my understanding is that this is the Senate language.
Okay, perhaps a testifier could very briefly outline the substantive changes in the amendment, and then we can adopt the amendment, get the bill in the shape the author would like it. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Berkmore. I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Traffic Safety within the Department of Public Safety. What this amendment is language that doesn't yet match up with the Senate language, but it will when they actually adopt the amendment as well. We have worked with Senator Latz to get language in there that would make the bill more consistent with our current statute and also something that could be implemented well. So it's just fine-tuning the language that Senator Latz had proposed. But it has not been adopted in the Senate at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Berkmore. Could you, for the purposes or for the benefit of the committee, and since we don't have an electronic format, can you just quickly describe, I see three main substantive additions, or maybe they're not substantive, but just looking at lines 1.10 and 1.11, I just want to make sure that, that Representative Westrum is given a fair opportunity to understand what we're looking at here as well.
Absolutely. A lot of it is just some basic changes. I think you can see that, like individual to individual and things like that. We're changing the report date to a time after the actual pilot is over. The current bill has the report due before the pilot is done, so some dates like that. The substantive changes are, in the bill as it stands, it requires that a limited license be issued to the individual who would be part of the pilot program. And with that limited license, they'd also have written on the driver's license card this restriction. That is a very expensive change for driver and vehicle services. My understanding is about $70,000, and there's not a reason for that. That can be on the driving record. Limited licenses are the driving records, and law enforcement across the state has access to driving records through the computers in their cars. In fact, they use that more than the license itself because that's up to date. The card may not be. So that's gone. We deleted that and made clear that it would be on the driving record and available to law enforcement. Another piece of this is to make it clear that it would be monitored through the court system. We have Hennepin County is interested and Beltrami County is interested in the probationary where they're dealing with both DWI offenders and other individuals with substance abuse in the probation system. And we think that's the best way to do that. So this clearly keeps it in the probation section and not in the driver's license evaluation. We're dealing with the whole person in the driving and the alcohol. And let's see. The other thing it does is, because this is a pilot, instead of clearly stating exactly all the rules of how long a person has the license, we're leaving it to driver and vehicle services and the court system to work out those details. One of the things that we would also prefer is that it makes sense as far as progression between a first-time offender, a second-time offender, and how serious their crime was. So they're leaving that to the discretion of the department, and that would be reported on. So if this would ever be adopted, permanent law, we have that information instead of having it static in law.
Thank you very much, Ms. Burkmore. Chair Mullery, would you like to move the A2 amendment? Any questions about the A2 amendment? All those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Welcome to the committee, ma'am, and state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lynn Gogler, and I am the vice chair of Mothers Against Drunk Driving here in Minnesota. I'm also a victim of drunk driving, as both my parents were killed by a drunk driver. Just to give you a little background here, since 1980, Matt has been at the forefront of this battle to stop people from making the decision to drink and then get into their cars. Over the last 26 years, we've fought to make laws, change laws, revise laws, and most importantly, to educate the public. We also provide victim services for those that need help in the recovery process at no charge to the victim. It's our mission to eliminate drunk driving. Our mission includes four key strategies, one of which is the implementation of the alcohol ignition interlock device. MAD believes that anyone who violates the public trust by driving at .08 or above deserves an alcohol ignition interlock device. The main reason why people continue to drink and drive in today's world, despite 26 years of education and the efforts of our law enforcement, is simply because they can't. Approximately 40,000 people were arrested last year in Minnesota for drunk driving, and out of that, one-third or 12,000 were repeat offenders, an enormous amount of individuals. Ignition interlock devices are really a part of the solution. Considering that between 50 and 75% of those whose licenses are suspended or revoked as a result of driving under the influence continue to drive without their license, revoking a license does have a strong deterrent effect, but it's not always enough. Ignition interlocks prevent people who have alcohol in their system from driving a car. An operator breathes into an interlock device to determine blood alcohol concentration. If there is a measurable alcohol in the blood, the vehicle does not start. As you might expect, this is quite effective. Interlock devices have shown to reduce subsequent offenses while they are on the vehicle by 50 to 90%. Some say the solution is too intrusive or too expensive. We believe that, on the contrary, interlocks represent a fine balance between taking a license away from a person for a long period of time or letting them get back on the road and back into society. An interlock device in conjunction with restrictive licenses and recommended treatment will allow a person to legally drive between work and school, maintain his or her employment. We support this program because we feel that we can build a very effective system in Minnesota to allow that repeat offender to drive safely and not endanger the safety of the public. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gogler. Gogler, is that correct?
Gogler.
Gogler. Thank you. And Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, and the both at the Office of Traffic Safety and the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services have worked with the authors to ensure that the department would be able to administer this pilot program and provide us with the authority to work with the probation department in making sure that the program would result in people trying to work within the restrictions that our department sets in terms of DWI violations.
Thank you very much, Ms. McCormick. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And quick question. I have a very big interest in this. I just think it's kind of a neat concept. I've read a little bit about it. The one question that I have that maybe somebody could answer is, and maybe even Representative Cornish could chime in on this, is about the calibration, or maybe talk a little bit about how the actual device works, because I know that there's some issues when you're dealing with breathalyzer tools about the calibration of the device.
Ms. Brickmore.
Mr. Chair, Representative, The language of the pilot actually has the Department of Public Safety involved in certifying the equipment that would be used. That would be done by the BCA. We most likely would expect the machines, the ignition interlocks, to be calibrated monthly, but that would be required initially of the provider. And so that would be a part of their contract that they would have to calibrate monthly, because they are also getting reports to help monitor an individual monthly.
Representative Westrom?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the witness, I forget her last name. Couple things. First of all, you mentioned the cost of these. Some say it's too expensive. But what kind of money are we talking about here?
Ms. Berkmar, Ms. Galbraith?
Members of the committee, it's my understanding. Thank you.
Ms. Galbraith.
It's my understanding that this device costs between $9 and $10 a day to have it on your car, which is usually less than what a person is spending to drink.
$9 to $10 a day.
Representative Westman.
So, Mr. Chair, it's a temporary device. It's not put on their car permanently.
Ms. Berkmore?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, it would be put on their car. It can also be taken off of their car, and it would be once they're off of the program. We have somewhat different information about the cost. It can be, we've seen states that have had it for about $60. Dollars, which is more like $2 a day a month, $60 to $75 a month, and that cost is usually borne by, again, the individual who would be getting the benefit of having it on their car and being able to drive with a limited license.
So,
Representative Westrom.
Chair, first obvious thing comes to mind is, well, oftentimes people driving without a license, as you said, or in other things, What's to prevent them from walking next door to their friend or buddy and say, hey, can I drive your car to the bar tonight instead? Wouldn't that be an obvious loophole that would be hard to close?
Representative Westrom, just for your information, the A2 amendment that we adopted includes this language, just for fair notice. It's a misdemeanor for a person who is licensed under this section for driving a vehicle equipped with an ignition interlock device, and then subdivision one is to start or attempt to start the vehicle with the interlock device. But number two is to drive, operate, or be in physical control of a motor vehicle other than a vehicle properly equipped with an ignition interlock device. So that, I mean, let me not actually address your question.
No,
but,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Westrom,
be a penalty, but driving without it with a revoked license, I think, is a misdemeanor as well, and so similar type penalty. I think it's a good worth a try. I mean, I'm not saying that. I just think that could be the issue. Lastly, Mr. Chair, and to the lady from NAD, seems to me that a bill that I've worked on and an amendment over the last 4 or 5 years and just hasn't seemingly gotten the support of the right groups, but I'm wondering if you'd be supportive of it. That was to open up the changing the state laws that right now are restricting the use of a breathalyzer in the bars, and my idea in the amendment language is to give everybody the access to this information, because the education would be invaluable, and my summary or my hypothesis based on people that have brought me this idea and more I've talked to. There's lots of people that go out on a Friday or Saturday night in a group. Four people are drinking and they try to figure out who drank the least tonight. And why not give them that information as they pay for a breathalyzer test before they leave the bar, and the bar establishments simply aren't putting them in because of liability issues primarily today. Would you support legislation like that as well, so we could even get non-offenders and non-violators of the .08 law more information, so when they're leaving the bar they can be more informed and decide to sit back for a half hour and drink some water if they're over the limit?
Ms. Galbraith?
Members of the committee, First, I'd have to really look at a bill like that, but I would tell you in general we would not support that bill because while I think the idea is there, there are several unintended consequences to that type of breathalyzers in a bar. Who's going to be responsible for calibrating them? People will begin to make a game of it. Let's see if we can get to 0.08. There have been a lot of studies that show that even though it is illegal to drink and drive over a BAC of 0.08, there certainly are people that can drive in a rather hazardous condition that are under 0.08. Whether you're eating food or not can affect you. There are a lot of unintended consequences to that. There's a liability involved in it. Who's going to calibrate it? Who's going to be responsible for it? And there are a lot of people that simply find it intrusive to have to do something like that.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Western, one last day.
I'm actually quite repulsed at your answer, Madam, to the witness. First of all, you obviously haven't followed much of the literature that's been out or the legislation, which would be exemplified in your answer. We address some of those issues, and we'd be happy to address them. Those are solvable problems. I'm quite shocked that you'd be that of against getting more people informed before they are driving, and it almost makes me question what is your real motive. If you're against that type of common sense legislation, I'm actually paused to even support this because I'm wondering if you've got a different motive than what you're displaying.
Representative Westrum and members to the bill before us, I think I can't remember, Representative Lester, if you were around. I honestly can't remember when Judge James Dean presented in the joint committee that we had earlier this week, where about the Towards Zero Death program, where he cited that 772 times is the average number of impaired driving incidents before getting caught with a DWI. So I think that you're I think you're on the, I share your concern about the issue. I would just really encourage you and Ms. Gawler to meet and discuss this issue outside of committee and find some common ground, because I think you'll find a lot more. But I'm with you on looking at the big problem, and it's a huge concern. It's a huge concern. I have Representative Paymar, and then Saylor, and then Coles, and then we'll see if we can lay the bill over for possible inclusion and solve some of these issues if we have any.
I don't know if this is for Representative Mullery or someone from DCS. First of all, nowhere in the bill does it say, it talks about the commissioner. I'm assuming you mean the commissioner of public safety. Seems to me we probably should state that somewhere. But I have a question about the pilot project. Do you have a metropolitan county and a rural county chosen to participate in the project? This is sort of a three-part question, I guess. And it seems like we're asking the department to do a fair amount of work to put this together. They report back to the legislature, evaluate the successes and the failures of the project, provide information on participation. The commissioner shall issue a driver's license for individuals whose driver's licenses have been revoked under this project, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me there would be a cost to this, and it's not spelled out in the bill. So,
Chairman Mullery, Representative Paymar, are you good to go?
That's it.
Representative Chair Mullery.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Paymar, it is the Commissioner of Public Safety. Second question, you must not have been here. They stated that Hennepin and Beltrami were the two counties.
Okay.
And third was that it's a federally financed pilot project, I believe.
So it's just, Mr. Chair, so it's
not going straight through
the actual
Chair Mullery. Ms. Burkmore.
I think we have a two-part answer because I can respond to what the federal funds can do, and then Ms. McCormick will respond to driving vehicle services part. Our Office of Traffic Safety is a federally funded office, and we grant money out. So I'm not going to go much farther than that. But we have a large pot of alcohol money that every year we decide how we're going to spend it. We have projects already in the courts, in probation, working with DWI defenders. So without having to make any changes with the feds, a current project will fit into this. So it's not often that we have something that comes from across the legislature that we say, hey, that fits into something we're going to be able to do, but this fits. So that's why there's federal that will deal with the probation, and we will help out the extra costs in Beltrami and in Hennepin. We cannot help in driver vehicle services because there's limits for those funding, and this
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Haymeyer, the amendment that has been drafted does, while the commissioner and the driver and vehicle services will certainly be working with the probation department, the way the amendment is drafted, that would alleviate our the additional driver evaluator that we would need, and also I think make for a more effective program with our division working with the probation department, so that we're really dealing with any treatment issues and issues in terms of rehabilitation.
Thank
you.
Representative Palmer.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier that just spoke, I'm sorry I was gone when you spoke about this earlier, but I just wanted to clarify on, again, on this section two, just a little bit more. Did the counties apply already for this? And again, I apologize for being absent when you talked about this initially. Did they apply or were they chosen arbitrarily?
Ms. Brickmore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, they were chosen, but they weren't chosen necessarily arbitrarily, because what we looked for is probation. Counties with probation, they're already working with DWI offenders in a special DWI type court setting. Not every court system has that at this point, and so they're progressive, they're ahead. They are already acting as pilots in this area for the state, and it was Senator Latz's wish, and it made a lot of sense to us, that we also go to a metro county and a rural county to see how the program works in the different areas.
Just to follow up, and so the county is all fine with being chosen with this. They're a willing participant, shall we say.
Ms. Brickmore.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We wouldn't be here without that.
Great. Good answer. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. maybe for Representative Muller, one of the witnesses, I'm not sure. Whether the cost is $60 a month or it's $300 a month, obviously somebody has to bear that cost. And I believe you testified that it was typically the offender that bears that cost. But if we're providing this for offenders, what happens with individuals who qualify for public defender services? Are we setting ourselves up to having to provide this type of a system and incur additional court costs, state costs, et cetera? I guess that's one of the concerns. I like the bill. I like what we're trying to do, but that's a concern I would have.
Ms. Brickmore?
I'll do my best on this, Mr. Chair. I believe at this point that would be something that the court system, the probation would work through. We don't have something set up for an indigent population. Jean, do you know anything different than that?
Would you like to just testify through the...
Yeah.
welcome to the committee, please. Please state your name for the record and answer the question as briefly as you can, please.
Hi, my name is Jean Ryan. I'm from the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety within the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chair, Representative. The plan is to work it out with the particular pilot counties, whether that is... Many states have an indigent fund, and they actually... the provider actually has to provide that indigent fund when you work with that the interlock provider. There's been some discussion with the counties whether, as a pilot, because we're not going to maybe have a contract with the provider in this situation, we may want to fund some of that, but it would be very limited, and we would not do it as a long-term thing. That would not be something that we would want to do, is provide. It would be... It's a long-term project. We would want to do it, or a program. We would want to do it through an indigent fund, similar to every other state.
Thank you very much.
Not every other state, but many other states.
Representative Coles, you good? Thank you. Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mallory and guests. Thank you for... I'm really excited about this project tonight. I know some other states have, I think, tried this statewide, and I'm glad that we're trying it, and happy to, you know, see the results as they come forward. So thank you for this effort, Representative Mallory and others.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was out of the room for a moment, so I didn't hear this, but this is something that people breathe into, correct, so that they you know whether they're 0.08 or not. Is there a way to identify that the driver is actually the one who is doing the breathing and not a child who's with the driver who happens to be doing the breathing?
Ms. Brickmore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, there's actually training that the individual is given to actually learn how to blow into the instrument. There's nothing that actually can identify DNA or something as they're blowing into it. But normally, I don't know that that's been an issue. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in addition to that, they do have rolling retests. So once you breathe into it, to get the car started, but then like 5 minutes into the travel, you have to breathe into it, depending on how it's a random thing, you have to breathe into it again. So you can't just have somebody start the vehicle and then drive freely without some kind of recheck at some point of your travels.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought I had remembered something years ago in which some of the instruments could be manipulated by a child in the passenger seat or something like that. So I think it was a long time ago, but I don't recall.
Representative Cornish?
Is there any way that you could modify the instrument so that it would shock the offender unconscious and you just throw the cuffs on him and he gets
it? Representative Cornish, is that the
shoot him too?
I thought you were going to go all the way, Representative Cornish. Yeah, I think there's some stronger law and order protection we can take. But members, we have at least three more bills before or after this bill, and two of which was, I think, take some substantive testimony and discussion. So not to dissuade members from asking important questions, but if there's any remaining representative of the lady testing
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much, Chair Mullery. We will lay over House File 2229 for possible inclusion, as amended, for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill. And next should be Representative Tim Faust, whose office is like five. And will be House File 1824. Which. Yeah. Members, we will start with Representative Faust's bill here in a second. And appreciate the patience of those waiting to testify on the predatory lending bills.
Maybe there's an introduction.
No. I would. the certain position at which we stand close happens to be will soon become my wife. And it's not happy.
It's not happy. The last is the reason for the last.
I believe so.
You don't.
But one certain
man I complain. Might not look like it, but you don't miss one.
I would actually not make that statement at all about you. From our informal non-recess, we are returning to business, and I will bring us back to order here. Representative Faust, welcome to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee. I believe that you have House File 1824.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Isn't that it?
We do have the bill physically. I want to confer with staff to make sure that we have the bill formally before us.
You do not.
Okay, we will be, members and Representative Faust, we will not be taking formal action on House File 1824, but this is an informational hearing, and so is there any opposition here to the bill? from the public, Representative Calls. You can't always turn in your election certificate, but I believe you can't get it back as easily. Representative Faust, thank you for coming before us. Thank you for your flexibility and present your bill.
Thank you very much. And when we do hear this, I do want to present a very small amendment on page 4.3. After the word employee, we want to add in or agent. So the sentence would read, if the certified amusement rider or inspector is not an employee or agent of the insurance company. So if I do not happen to be there when you take this up, which I don't know what the practice is, I'd appreciate it if you could add that in.
I believe Representative Faust, I believe we'll be ultimately sending this bill if it does pass out of this committee successfully, then we will be sending it to the General Register, so we will be sure to make that amendment as you wish. Proceed, Representative Faust.
Thank you very much. First, I'm going to start out by saying that we've discussed this bill with the Trade Association for the Outdoor Amusement Businesses Association and their representatives and three carnival owners from Minnesota about this, and they all support this. There's one minor change that they want to make, and we're going to work that out with them within the next couple of days. We've also discussed this with the Ann Flynn from the League of Minnesota Cities, and they support this. So we really have not run into much opposition at all. There were a few small areas that the Lawyers Association has some issues with, and we're working on that as well. So we're trying to work this out to make everybody happy, which is sometimes very hard to do, but that's what we're trying to do. So anyway,
if I could real quickly, Representative Faustin, this is just a first termer speaking to a fellow first termer, but the bill will be before us, and deadline is Friday, so just we'll have to move this bill to the floor so that whatever settlement and agreement you guys can come to, you'll have to do that by Friday.
No problem.
I just want to...
I appreciate that.
Appreciate it, Representative.
Thank you.
To the bill in how?
To the bill.
5 minutes?
No problem.
Great. Thank you.
This bill came to me because there was an accident up in Hinkley last summer where two young girls fell out of an amusement ride. And so there's been some proposed changes to some of the rules that regulate that. And to present those to you, I have from the Department, Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, John Schultz. So I'll turn it over to him and let him go through the changes as quickly as he is able.
Mr. Schultz?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is John Schultz. I'm one of the assistant directors with the Department of Labor and Industry in the Construction Codes and Licensing Division. I'm actually responsible for the administration of 184B, as well as the electrical inspection requirements that also apply to amusement rides. The department looked at the current language in 184B and believed that it needed to be strengthened somewhat to ensure that the department had the tools to ensure that the intent of the current law is actually complied with. And again, drafted this language, worked within the industry, checked the various similar laws in other states. The intent was not to create an onerous law, but to simply strengthen it so that it could be more easily tracked. Just a few of the points. Again, it requires annual inspection and requires that inspection to be done in a timely manner. The concern we have is that in some instances the inspections may occur well after the carnival has operated in Minnesota for the season and has left the state. It doesn't seem reasonable to have an inspection after the fact rather than in a more timely manner. Also requires that inspections be performed by certified inspectors. It identifies two different certification entities. This, again, is somewhat consistent with other states and their requirements. Also requires that the insurance certificates and inspection affidavits actually be, in addition to be filed with the event sponsors, also be filed with the department, so the department's in a position to actually ensure that there is adequate
insurance and that the actual individual rides that are being inspected are actually the ones that are being operated so that there is that verification. It also requires that the rides be inspected daily by the ride operators. Requires them to keep a log to ensure that they're actually performing those inspections and that those rides are in working a good working order. Also requires recording and reporting of rider illnesses and accidents so that and there's also some reporting requirements where there's more serious illnesses or injuries so that there's an awareness and that the department can react to that. Also requires some posting of safety rules so that the public and the users have a general awareness of what the ride rules are as far as the operation. One of the things that is part of the consolidation with the Construction Codes and Licensing Division within the department, this will actually enable a partnering of 184B with the electrical inspection requirements. So as the electrical inspections are being done on these same attractions, we'll be able to actually coordinate the inspections. That's the end of my presentation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Schultz. You got the one-minute warning 59 seconds too late, I suppose. Any questions, members? Representative Westrum, as concisely as we can.
What are we doing with this bill, laying it over?
We are doing nothing with this bill tonight because we actually don't formally have it before us to quirk with the Commerce Committee. But
Mr. Chair,
when we get it, I believe we'll be passing it to the General Register. That's what we discussed, right, Representative Fels? Yes. Representative Westrum.
That's presuming we actually have the votes to get out of this.
Exactly. Yes. Which was my initial presumptive.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, are we setting up more bureaucracy, more agencies to do this inspecting? What's wrong with the current practice?
Mr. Schultz?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrum. Actually, not at all. It really is just strengthening the current statute 184B. Currently, for example, it really doesn't create more reporting. The certificates of insurance now are required to be provided to the sponsors of the events. However, the department doesn't get a copy of those. So there's no way for the department to effectively track whether or not there's actually insurance on a particular amusement ride or not. It also doesn't have any, because it doesn't get affidavits of inspection, it doesn't have any awareness or a way to track whether the inspections have actually been performed on a particular ride. Again, there is no fiscal impact on this because it's simply going to be incorporated into the other inspection activities that the department currently does. The electrical inspection program that the department administers is actually much more robust, and it's actually those inspections are actually done by department personnel. In this instance, the inspections will continue to be done by third parties, insurance companies, et cetera, that are insuring those rides. So there's no actual new requirement for that. It's just somewhat of an enhancement of the reporting procedures.
So, Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, we call it an enhancement. It sounds like more paperwork required for the business operating the carnival. Wouldn't you agree?
As concisely as possible, Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westbrook. They're already providing the information to the local sponsors of the events, the county fairs, the carnival sponsors. It might be a church group. It might be a community. It simply requires them to also provide that information to the department so that that information can be tracked to ensure that it is actually being done.
Well,
Representative Western.
And I know this is the problem we try to rush through bills. Maybe we shouldn't be doing so many. They're already providing it to the locals. Why doesn't the department, if they need it, just go to the locals and get it? If they don't trust the locals, then why? They're the ones contracting. It should be their their business. Mr. Howie has to provide it to the locals and to the state. It seems like when there's a problem, the state can go to the locals, and maybe we should just pass a law that says local units have to turn it over to the state upon request.
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom. Unfortunately, at the time that the department may be interested is after the fact, after there's been an incident, it's better to be able to ensure that the inspections have actually taken place and that the insurance is actually in place before the fact rather than after the fact. And that's a good example is that an insurance carrier may cancel the insurance for that particular attraction, that particular carnival operator, and the local group may not even have that awareness. They may not be notified. Similarly, they may not have any idea whether that's the same Tilted World that was actually inspected or if this is a different one that this particular carnival operator operates or owns. It provides a means by which the department can very easily, readily ensure that there is compliance with the law that's currently stated.
Representative Westrom, any follow-up or ready to proceed? Representative
Coles, like the government, Mr. Chairman, that we probably don't need.
I think Representative Coles might have a nice little clip that I'm going to let you go ahead and make.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say something about this bill being amusing, but I won't do that. I just looked at 184B as it currently reads. I just read through it. It's fairly short. I see we're doubling the insurance requirements from $1 million to $2 million. In the aggregate. We're not only, as Representative Westrom discussed, requiring a bunch of additional record reporting, but you know, we've got this, we've got the safety rules that you got to post on the, we're protecting people from themselves. I have no problem with, we already require the amusement industry to do the inspections. It just seems like we've got a solution here in search of a problem. I don't want to make light, Representative Faust, of the situation that happened in Hinckley, and that's not my intent at all. But I'm not sure that this bill would have prevented the accident that happened in Hinckley. Can you tell? Would the regulations here have prevented the accident that happened, the tragedy that happened in Hinckley?
Representative Faust, briefly, and we'll move on.
Likely not.
But
it may have prevented other accidents from happening. In the past when other accidents have happened.
Representative Coles?
Mr. Chair, it just seems like big government getting bigger, and I don't think it's necessary. I don't know that it's going to prevent accidents. That's what they are. They're tragedies, and we can try to regulate our way out of all of them, but it's not going to work. And I think we're fooling ourselves if we think we are. So we'll take up the votes, I guess, when we have the bill in front of the committee.
It'll be interesting, certainly. Representative Faust. So.
I understand what you're saying, and I'm not one that likes to push big government, but I guess that when the group of people that are mostly affected by this, the people that are operating the carnivals, are all saying this is good, this is not a bad thing, we don't have a problem with this, I have a hard time saying that we're putting bureaucracy on top of somebody when they're the ones that will be most affected by it and they support it. So I guess that I think that is probably the best argument against it.
Mr. Chair,
Coles, are you sure that you want to
talk?
Go ahead, Representative Coles.
Let the market work. If it's what they ought to be doing, then they ought to do it. And the market ought to, if that's what they, I'm guessing, Representative Coles, they're probably telling you they don't have a problem with it because they're already doing it. They probably already are carrying $2-4 million of insurance, I'll stop, Mr. Chair, but it seems silly.
Representative Westrom, briefly, and then I'll let Representative Faust and Mr. Schultz and then Representative Faust kind of clean up here, and we'll wait for the bills to come in.
Faust, there's a way we could change this, and as we discussed this, I'm wondering, rather than have the department add one more thing that they're going to collect a bunch of paperwork on that most of it they'll never use or need, maybe it's just a matter of them getting a list of the county fair operations and city units in the state and just sending them a notice and a reminder once a year, here's what you need to do with your carnivals that you're contracting with, and we as a state may request you for this information, but get it up front and let the locals be the proactive persons. It just seems like we don't need that much more government collecting that much more paperwork for the limited number of incidents there are that I think we'd all agree we aren't going to eliminate all of them ever anyways, and it can happen.
Mr. Schultz, briefly, and then Representative Faust, some closing comments, and then we'll move on.
One of the concerns that the department has, Mr. Chair, and Representative Westrum and Coles, is that the way the current law is worded, it does require an annual inspection. However, the department has awareness of incidences where amusement rides may be piggybacked onto another carnival operator. And there's a question as to whether or not those rides are ever inspected, because they may only be operated every other year, every third year. Supposedly they're piggybacked onto the insurance of the other operator. There is no real assurance that those rides are ever inspected. That's one of the concerns that the more responsible carnival operators have also. That they're recognizing that there are entities out there that are skirting the current requirements that are required to be administered by the Department of Labor and Industry, and that's one of the problems as such, is that even though the filing is required to be done with the sponsors, it's still the responsibility to administer with the Department of Labor and Industry, so it still has that responsibility.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that I would agree with what Mr. Schultz has said, is that there are some things that are not currently being done. I mean, you know, the carnival owners are very concerned about safety, and I think that, you know, for the most part, it is a very safe industry. I don't dispute that. But at the same time, there are some things in this bill that they are not doing that they have agreed they should be doing. And so if you say, well, then they should just do them on their own, that's fine for the ones that want to comply, but that's not fine for the ones that choose not to. So I think this is one of the things where, you know, better safe than sorry. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Faust and Mr. Schultz. And obviously, Representative Faust, will be in your interest to be here when we do take up 1824 formally. Thank you.
Chair, when do you think that will be?
I believe I actually am not in a position to be able to answer that question, but I think that I'm hearing that. I think you heard it too. That obviously Friday is deadline, so it will be either. It will most likely be Friday, because it sounds like they're working on an amendment, unless Chair Mullery has other plans.
I think we're going to have to probably. Friday is for the markups on the omnibus, and we're not going to set those aside for these. We'll probably have to do them tomorrow.
Sounds like we'll be having taken off tomorrow, Representative Westrum.
Yeah.
Representative Dabney, thank you so much for your patience and for your testifiers as well. A little curious about the stacks of paper that Mr. Watson is carrying around, but
just doing our part for the forest products industry.
And Representative Stolberg will be happy to hear that. I believe we do not formally have
Representative of Unius might not be.
We try to. Yeah, I'll leave that one alone.
In the interest of time,
a lot of trouble. I believe we do not have bill formally before us. Is that correct, Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. You do, however, have the H-1004 draft informational engrossment, which the revisor's office was good enough to prepare, because I wanted to ensure that the committee did have the most up-to-date text in front of them, although I think the revisers would make it clear this is an informal piece. This is not an official engrossment, and I don't want to over-represent it.
I do appreciate that very much, Representative Dabney, and this is a first for me. Many things are first for me as a first-termer, but I've not yet seen a draft informational engrossment.
It was so. First for me as well.
It's good to hear. Proceed to present your bill, Representative Dabney.
Thank you.
I do apologize for cutting you off there. In terms of what we intend to do with the two bills, your bill and then Chair Mullery's bill, I believe that if we do 8 minutes of presentation here, and then is there anyone here in opposition to Representative Dabney's bill to House 1004? Okay. And to 931. All right. Well, I guess Representative Downey, we'll ask you to keep the presentation portion to 8 minutes, and then we'll see how we go on discussion, and then and obviously your two bills are very closely related. So.
All right.
Thank you. Proceed. Appreciate your patience.
Thank you. The clock is running, Mr. Chair and members. The House File 1004, which is in front of you at this time, deals with the issue of predatory lending, particularly predatory lending in the subprime market. The financial services industry is a very different place than it was even a decade ago. Market changes and developments, the internet, and other dynamics have allowed a wide variety of new mortgage products and expanded access to credit for many borrowers. Subprime lending has provided opportunities to many previously cut out of home ownership. But with these positive developments have also come the ugly downside of predatory lending practices by some in the industry. They target primarily communities of color, low-income communities, and the elderly for high fees, escalating interest rates, unfavorable terms, churning, and other abusive practices. These loans are disproportionately involved in the rising wave of foreclosures across the state. Hennepin County saw an 81% increase in foreclosures from 2005 to 2006. Scott County, a 122% increase. But don't think that this is just a metro issue. Stearns County saw a 62% increase in foreclosures in that same time period. St. Louis, a similar amount. Blue Earth, a 56% increase. And more to come. A dramatic number of adjustable rate mortgages across the country are scheduled to unlock in May and June of this year. Simply put, predatory lending is bad for consumers, bad for the lending industry, bad for our communities, and bad for our economy. House File 1004 is an outgrowth of the Attorney General's recent predatory lending study group that included local and state elected officials, business leaders, bankers, and others knowledgeable in the mortgage lending industry. I'd like first to, if I may, Mr. Chair, to have Mr. Dean Rose, who's been good enough to join us tonight. He's a North Minneapolis small business person, probably well known to the chair of this committee, as his family has owned stores in the area for a number of generations, I believe, to discuss the impact of predatory lending on communities.
Happy to do so. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Rose. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Dean Rose. I'm the owner of the Bean Scene Coffee House and Internet Cafe in North Minneapolis, as well as my family has been for three generations the owner of Broadway Liquor Outlet on West Broadway Avenue in North Minneapolis. We employ many, many individuals from within our community, and I'm here today to offer my perspective on how foreclosures destabilize our local community. I have personally experienced two of my employees within the past 18 months who have gone through a foreclosure and have lost their homes due to bad lending practices. And I'm here to tell you today that it is debilitating to them personally as well as to my business climate. It impacts my business because of lost productivity. Watching somebody unravel when their financial affairs fall apart and they begin to realize that they're going to lose their home through bad lending practices, it's incredible to watch it happen before your eyes. It leads not only to lost productivity, it's demoralizing, and it actually hurts what I do, and that is sell coffee. What it does is it makes the service that we provide to our community and within our community less than what it should be, because my employees don't have their heads in the game to what we do best, and that is serve people. In addition to that, the foreclosures impact our neighborhood by leading to vacancies, and eventually which leads to increased crime. There's nothing worse than having a block that has two or three vacant houses on it that creates an unsafe environment within our community. Lastly, I'd just like to say that it's imperative for me as a business owner to have a vibrant work environment for my employees. Those who are looking, who are less educated and are trying to find a means to financial stability, use home ownership as a wonderful way to get there. And if you can tighten the loopholes so that lenders can't take advantage of these people who don't have perhaps the education level to understand what is necessary and what is they are entitled to, it will help strengthen our entire community. Thank you,
Mr. Rose. Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, I'd now ask that Ms. Hawkins from the Legal Services Advocacy Project come forward. She will walk members through the bill and note in particular areas that we have already amended in response to ongoing negotiations to date with stakeholders in the community, including the lending community.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hawkins. And state your name for the record, present your testimony, and as briefly as you can, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Amber Hawkins. I'm an attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. For the last several years, I have represented and worked with homeowners who have been victimized by abusive lending practices. I also spent some time working on these issues at the Attorney General's office. Legal Aid was a member of the Attorney General's Predatory Lending Study Group and participated in some of the recommendations that gave rise to this bill. Rather than going through the bill page by page in the interest of time, I would just highlight what the bill does, and if anyone has questions about the substantive provisions, I'd be happy to answer them. The first thing this bill does is it prohibits mortgage brokers from waiving their duty to act in the borrower's best interest. Basically, members of the committee, when a borrower goes to a mortgage broker, it is their expectation that this person is going to shop around and get them a good, fair deal on a loan. That's why they go to a mortgage broker rather than calling a bank directly, when they know that if they call the bank directly, they're going to get a product that bank sells that maybe perhaps isn't the best rate for them. Under current law, if mortgage brokers give their clients a disclosure at the first meeting, they do not have to act in the best interest of that person. And the bill would stop that from happening and require them to act in the best interest of the consumer that they're assisting in getting a loan. The second thing the bill does is it requires lenders to verify that the borrower has the ability to repay the loan. When I tell people this, a lot of people say to me, well, don't they already have to verify what a borrower's income is in order to get a loan? And the answer to that is no. There are loan products where a borrower can just simply say an income amount and there's absolutely no verification done. And there have been a lot of abuses in that area. So this bill would require that borrowers show a reasonable ability to repay the loan through some form of reliable documentation. I want to note a change that Representative Dabney has already made in the bill in response to industry concerns. With respect to the adjustable rate mortgages that many of you have probably been reading about in the newspapers, when the bill provides that when a lender is determining the borrower's ability to repay, they need to skip over the teaser rate and go to what's called the fully indexed rate, and that is the rate that the loan will go to when the teaser rate expires. Initially, the bill provided that the borrower also had to be able to afford the loan for the first, at the maximum rate it could reach in the first 7 years. That was taken out in response to the industry concerns. So the current bill just says take out the teaser rate, and can this borrower afford the mortgage at the fully indexed rate. The third thing the bill does is it prohibits churning. Many other states have a very similar provision. They call it flipping in other states, but because here in Minnesota we have some experience with practices on the north side of Minneapolis several years ago, a rash of fraudulent activity that is not the same as the practices we're talking about here, we call this churning. Basically, churning the loans.
I'm sorry. I can give you a hint to wrap it up as soon as you can.
Okay. Churning loans for fees rather than for the benefit of the borrower. So a loan can't be made unless it benefits the borrower in some way. That provision has also been altered to respond to the industry concerns. And I can explain later how that happened. The fourth provision this bill adds is when a lender is disclosing to a borrower what their payment is going to be on the new loan, they must disclose that an additional amount is going to be due for taxes and insurance if that is not included in the new loan. The reason for this, it's sort of a classic technique that's been used borrowers don't understand a lot of times that their new loan is not going to include an escrow. Many assume that their loan will include an escrow for taxes and insurance. So this just gets at the issue of comparing apples to apples. And borrowers are often sold on these low rates that they think are lower than their current payment when in actuality they don't include taxes and insurance. And finally, the bill prohibits loans with negative amortization, which means if you are the borrower and you are making regularly scheduled payments under the terms of your loan, you're not in default, your principal balance cannot be increasing. And currently there are lots and lots of loan products that or loans that are made where the borrower is having negative amortization occur every single month. Those are the major provisions of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hawkins. Representative Westrum.
Chairman, a couple points. Talking about the negative amortization, if they aren't making the payments, the interest is going to accrue. Is that not going to raise the amount of principal owed?
Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrum. The bill provides that if they are making regularly scheduled payments, so they're complying with the terms of their loan and they're not in default and it's negatively amortizing, that's what's prohibited.
Okay. Secondly,
Representative Westrum.
Do we really need to tell people if you got property taxes to pay on top of your mortgage and insurance? I mean, if they don't know this, maybe they shouldn't even be buying property.
Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrum. Many, especially senior citizens, have problems with that particular issue because they've had loans for a long period of time and there's always been an escrow. And, you know, traditionally, I'm sure if anyone in this room bought a house 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it was almost never the case where you wouldn't have an escrow. The lack of an escrow is really something that has popped up a lot more recently in recent years with some of the more risky subprime lending products. And other loan products. You can have other loans aren't required to have an escrow. I mean, some lenders choose to, some don't, but it's used predominantly in the subprime market and for riskier situations.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Western, one more follow-up?
Maybe more. So? My bank, and I wouldn't hardly call them subprime or any negative word that goes with it. I mean, they're a state chartered bank. They've never required me to pay escrow. In some cases, I choose not to. In some cases, I do. But you're paying somebody to do escrow if you pay it. And so I think that's a little presumptuous. I'll leave that where it is. The Department of Commerce has talked about tightening up mortgages. I'm hearing from some of my mortgage companies, and they're saying they're concerned with some of the plans coming out. I don't see in this bill some of their concerns. Is there other bills out there, Representative Dabney, dealing with minimum financial statement, net worth balances, and things like that? Or is this the main mortgage lender bill that's coming through?
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrom. The bill that you're referring to with the barriers to entry to the mortgage brokerage industry, I think that's right.
I believe that is correct.
Is actually a Department of Commerce bill that's being carried by Representative Atkins in this House. So this is not that bill.
This isn't that.
Representative Westrom.
Do you anticipate, Mr. Chair, do you anticipate Representative Dabney, these two going separately? Where is this one going? Is that one coming here? Mr. Chair, maybe you know that. I'd be curious. I'd like to just see exactly what we're doing in total to the mortgage industry. And I agree, if there's a way to clean up some of the riffraff that apparently is out there. But I have several mortgage companies in the Alexandria area where housing's exploded, and to my knowledge, none of them are riffraff. And I'm just concerned we don't sweep some of the good away with the bad.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I think, first of all, we're trying to do this with the mortgage industry, not to the mortgage industry. And there have been extensive and frequent meetings with various stakeholders trying to find more common ground. And as Ms. Hawkins demonstrated, we found it in some areas already. We've got some agreements in concept on some other areas and still some points of conflict that we're hoping to work through. It's been interesting to note to me that the harshest descriptions and the harshest language used to describe the mortgage industry have come from the mortgage industry themselves, not from myself or others who've been working on this. My intent to speak directly to your question is that this bill travels separately from Representative Atkins' bill.
Members, I believe that Representative Atkins' bill is not going to come to this committee, and that Representative Dabney's bill and Representative Mulery's bills will be laid over for possible inclusion, and since the chair's name is on one of them,
we're going to hold the floor also.
Oh, and so they will be laid over for possible inclusion, and as well as actually moving on their own to the general register should this committee vote to pass them out. So, Representative Steinman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Someone came to see me a couple of weeks ago about one of these, and forgive me, I don't know which one, raised possible federal preemption issues and talking to you. Is that a concern of yours? Or
Ms. Hawkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, federal preemption has been the bane of my existence as a plaintiff's attorney trying to handle predatory mortgage lending cases. It is very difficult for us to do many things that we would like to do and that should probably be done. There are within this bill, there is a possibility of one of the provisions being subject to federal preemption, but I think there's an argument to be made, and that's the negative amortization provision. We may be subject to preemption on that, which is probably why the industry isn't complaining about that provision. I'm not sure. Just to let you know where we've been at on this, that particular provision, for example, the industry has not expressed a single concern about us banning negative amortization. You'll notice that we have exempted federal and state chartered lending institutions from the provisions, most of the provisions in this bill, and that's largely due to the preemption issue.
Representative Simon, you're good?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Coles.
I'm going to try to be really quick with my questions. Hopefully I can get some quick answers, and we can. I just want to make sure I fully understand what we're doing. The fully indexed rate, the definition on page 2, line 6 through 8, my wife and I have a 5-1 ARM. So it can go up 5 points. It's got a cap of 5 points. So when we got our ARM several years ago, I still have a couple years left before it can adjust, and it can adjust that full 5 points in the first year. I knew that when I got the loan. The fully indexed rate, is that the initial value plus the 5 points that can go up?
Ms. Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Coles. The fully indexed rate would be the rate on your mortgage without the initial teaser rate. So I would have to see the exact terms of your note, but I'm going to make a couple of assumptions that you've got a rate that is, well, let me first say, every note out there, adjustable rate note, will have what's called a margin and an index. An index is it's a standard that tracks the current financial conditions. Many notes will use the LIBOR index or the Treasury index. And so they'll specify the index in your note and then your margin. Your margin never changes. So you might have index plus 5, index plus 4. It just depends on your note. So whenever your interest rate change is supposed to happen, they'll go to the index and they'll add the margin, and that's your interest rate. And then additionally, there will be usually a cap. If the index went through the roof, your note will say it can only go up 1% each time, for example. So what this bill does is at the time the loan is originated, we skip over your initial, let's say you got an initial 2% rate for a couple of years. All right, let's say 5.
At least 4.
That's a good rate.
It was a very good rate. I'm very pleased with that.
If it were 4%, we would skip that 4% and just look at what your fully indexed rate would be as of the date of origination. That's what you would have. You could still get the loan, but you would have to show that your income could afford that jump if it happened today.
Okay.
Representative Coles.
Thank you. And I think I understand that now. And you came to my second question, which is the borrower's reasonable ability to pay the principal and interest on the loan. I think it probably goes without saying that we can't ask a mortgage lender to make sure that a borrower isn't going to lose their job 2, 3, 4 years after they originate a loan. We're talking about ensuring a reasonable ability to pay on the day the mortgage is initiated, correct?
Ms. Hawkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I'm really glad that you asked that question because that was one of Representative Dabney's author's amendments. We initially had a 7-year lookout period. And now it's just on the date of the loan, can you afford this? Could you afford the fully indexed rate? I'd also like to add that federal regulators in October, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, and the FDIC came out with new guidance to the entities and banks that they regulate, saying that they want this standard of fully indexed rate used now in ARMs. They're gonna make their institutions abide by that standard, and we're just basically adopting the same standard for entities that we can regulate that are not subject to those federal regulators.
Representative Coles,
final question, Mr. Chair. Just help me understand again. I think Representative Danny, I don't want to give any problems here by telling you I think they like the bill.
That's twice tonight.
I know.
And
You think Representative Emmer's going to walk in and say the same thing?
I run for the room.
We did work well last year on the ID theft stuff. My question, though, and I just want to make sure I understand what I may be voting on either now or when it, more importantly when it comes to the floor. What kind of, can you talk a little bit to, I presume that if the bill is enacted, we are going to eliminate some mortgage products that are currently in the marketplace today. And the concern I have is that I have a real concern about eliminating consumer choice. If a consumer is fully informed about what they're getting into, and I don't have a problem with the assessment at the front end to make sure they can afford what they're getting into at the front end. But how many, you know, what kind of products are we getting rid of, and are we, how far down the path of reducing consumer choice are we going? You've got a hand up.
Representative Dammy, I was hoping there was a purpose to that 12 pounds of paper that you brought in. Representative Dammy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I think the first and best answer is the handout that you're seeing now, a study done by the Center for Responsible Lending that showed that states with aggressive predatory lending laws, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, West Virginia, were able to get the abuses out of the process while maintaining access to credit, and particularly access to credit for communities of color, low-end and low-income communities, those communities that are disproportionately offered subprime loans and disproportionately represented in predatory lending processes. And I want to also be clear that subprime is not equivalent with predatory lending. There is a place for subprime loans. It's made home ownership possible for people who previously would not have been able to enjoy the benefits. Predatory lending makes home losing available to people, and that's what we're trying to block here. I think most specifically, we are very concerned about no documentation loans, where people simply do not demonstrate any ability to pay any resources available, whether it's a paycheck stub or a savings bank statement or, you know, any resources. And there's some real questions in the field about the legitimacy of some of those loans when they're written.
Mr. Chair, just a very brief comment.
Thank you,
Representative. I guess, you know, just to sort of articulate where my head is at on this issue, you know, if you look in the securities world, for example, there is an assessment when somebody goes to purchase an equity, a stock, a bond, whatever. There is an assessment that has to be done by the principal in order to determine whether or not the person can really afford to get into what they're getting into. I don't have any problem with that at all. I think that makes sense. But that's really where it stops in the securities world. You can buy a piece of junk as long as you know you're buying a piece of junk. And I just don't want to. I don't want to get into the situation. I get a little concerned when these types of bills come up that we're preventing what maybe junk to you or me, maybe just as you described, you know, providing somebody with the ability to get into a home that they otherwise couldn't get into, and they can afford it. So I just get concerned about preventing consumer choice. So mm-hmm. I think your bill's headed in the right direction. I'll look at it more closely as it moves toward the floor and be happy to chat with you about any concerns I have. But thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
I'd like to actually move on in about 3 minutes from the bill. So just and Representative Hillstrom does have a question, okay. But if you can hold on.
And then I'll answer Representative Coles in response to Representative Hillstrom.
Why don't you just go ahead and be direct, Representative Dabney, and respond to Representative Coles as briefly as you can.
Just to clarify, because I'm sure Representative Coles will appreciate this even more than I do, there is not a suitability standard in this legislation. The lender needs to know and be able to demonstrate that you can afford it today. They don't need to be able to say, well, what's your risk tolerance? Where, you know, you're in the childbearing years. What's the chance of you having another child and one of you being out of the market for a number of months? They don't have to go there. They have to know that on the day you close, you can pay the bills.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let the committee know that I also served on the panel, the Predatory Lending Task Force, and you've done a great job in working out the issues with all the stakeholders as well. So nice bill, Representative Danny.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. I should have credited you, and I apologize.
Oh, no.
But the credit goes to the Attorney General's office, the staff from Legal Services, ACORN, and others who've been very intensely involved, and credit to members of the lending industry who've come in and met around the table. We've still got some distance to go. We've made some progress, and we hope to get this passed this year into law to strike the balance between protecting the consumers from abusive practices and assuring that there's a dynamic mortgage market available as widely and broadly as possible.
Thank you, Representative Dadney. Nice work, and we look forward to seeing you when we formally have the bill before us.
Look forward to it as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Our final bill of the evening is House File 931. I believe we'll be on a similar subject here. Members, we should have the 8.5 by 11 Xerox copy.
Mr. Chairman, I'm digging and not finding it, but okay. Not to say I don't have it.
This is Chairman Mullery's bill. 931. It's a predatory lending bill as well. We should have a 8.5 by 11. If you don't, we can. We may not actually have them handed out yet, which is unfortunate. If you guys can hold it. Members and Wayne, if you could check with Patrick about 931, would you?
Yes, I won't say.
I think good about you.
It's late. I think you've said enough, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mullery, I believe that we will, within about 90 seconds, have have the bill before us. What I'd like to do is first ask, is there anyone here in the public who would like to testify either for or against Representative Mullery's bill, House File 931. And as we have at least a decent background on the subject, I hope that we can be concise.
Is the bill before us, Mr. Chair?
The bill is not formally before us.
Right.
This is another informational hearing. We have, what we will have in about 2 minutes will be the bill as introduced. We do not have a draft informational engrossment, unfortunately, but were there amendments in Commerce?
Mr. Chairman, there were three.
Okay. Why don't we wait until we have the bill before us? Were any of them substantive?
Mr. Chairman, there were two that were substantive. We can go ahead and discuss the whole bill while we're waiting.
If you could discuss the bill without specific language as best you can.
I can explain.
Do you think we can do the presentation in 7 or 8 minutes?
I think we can do it much shorter than that.
Can we do it in 3 minutes? Can you name that tune in 2 notes? Chair Mullery, please proceed.
There was really no, this one was not the issue. It was Representative Downey's.
Very well. Proceed, Chair Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill has a few provisions that appeared. There was one that was controversial with the mortgage lenders, and we two of the amendments dealt with that so that they didn't have problems with that anymore. Basically, what this does mostly is the enforcement of the new provisions of Representative Dabney's bill. There's also a couple of other provisions in here. One is that if you're paying off a special loan, such as a no-interest loan or a forgivable loan, a lot of governments or foundations give out loans where if you live there 5 years, you get it free, or there may be no interest, or some of them are dependent on different types of things. If you're a mortgage broker and you're getting a borrower to pay that off, you need to go to a you need to send the borrower to a counselor just so they understand that they're giving up this great loan that they have. The other one is the prepayment penalties, and until 1996 they were banned on conventional loans, and then in 1996 we allowed them under certain conditions. And with the amendments to the bill that went on in conjunction with the mortgage brokers' desires, and especially the banks requested those, the amendments to this bill prevent them on subprime loans, but allow them to continue on others. For instance, one of the provisions I think allows them on any loan over roughly $400,000. We just figured if they got enough money for that, they can go to an attorney to be protected. And the others allow them on regular types of conventional loans. Then there's a criminal provision. If the mortgage originator knowingly places what's called a grossly unsuitable loan, and that's where either where the borrower can't repay it, for instance, if the PITI is over their income and available assets, or if the mortgage originated knowingly participates in materially fraudulent information on the borrower's income and assets. And thus, in other words, if the, for instance, the mortgage broker says, oh, you only have $1,000 a month in income, well, let's write down $2,000 and gets it through that way. The last thing that this bill does is it just provides the right of action, since often the government doesn't follow through on everything. And it just specifies the specifics of that cause of action. The borrower can sue for their losses caused either by the mortgage broker who acted in violation of this law, or for the borrower can also sue under the private right of action for any fraudulent overvaluing of the property by the appraisers in violation of our statutes, and I believe it's Chapter 82. And that was the Third Amendment was just Mr. Pinder caught a reference to the wrong chapter.
Thank you, Chair Mori. We're still waiting on photocopies of the bill. Oh, here they're coming. If we can hold on 1 minute, please.
I got it under 8 minutes.
You did it in 4:15. Nice work. Thank you. Is there anyone who wishes to testify to Chair Mullery's bill? He was not here when we asked before. Okay. Any questions from members? Representative Coles.
Not a question, just a comment. Chair Mullery, I haven't had a chance to dig into your bill yet. I'm just looking at it now. I probably should have done my homework before I got to committee, but I've been a little busy.
None of us have.
I just want to let you know, I know the bill's not before us. I'll look at it tonight, and I'm not sure if I have it tomorrow or on Friday, but I do have some concerns about the breadth of the remedies here. I like Representative Davin's bill, kind of what he's doing. I'm a little concerned just from things I've heard, and I, like I said, I haven't studied the bill closely enough. I know that the mortgage industry is very concerned about the breadth of some of the remedies and potential penalties that exist here. I'm going to take a close look at that. I'll be happy to chat with you if I can identify more precisely what my concerns are, but I guess a heads up that that's something that I'll be looking at. I know that a couple other people on this committee, members on my side of the aisle, have some of the similar concerns. We'll take a look at them and be happy to try to work with you as it moves forward. But just a heads up.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative
Paul. Chair Mullery.
In the other committees, that all of the objections were to the other parts of the bill, so I haven't heard those. As I said, the only part of my bill that I heard objection to was on the prepayment penalty, and that was from, I believe, Mr. Johnson's office, and I think he was one of the ones, and we worked it out with him.
Representative Cole. Mr. Chair, all I can tell you, Representative Mullery, is I had a number of mortgage brokers come and visit me a couple weeks ago when they had their day here at the Capitol, and they expressed grave concern about the breadth of the bill. I'm just telling you, I haven't had a chance to dig into it, but it's something that's been brought to my attention. I intend to look at. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Coles. Any other questions from members? Thank you very much, Chair Mullery and Ms. Hawkins, and thank you, members of the public, for sticking around. Members and public, we do appreciate your understanding with the glitch in protocol from the Commerce Committee. So with that, the meeting is indeed adjourned.